Welcome to the February 24th public meeting of the Air Resources Board. The meeting will come to order. I'm pleased to say we have a quiet agenda today, but a lot of really interesting and good substance to discuss. Before we begin, we will please all rise and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. The clerk will please call the roll.
Dr. Balmes? Ms. Berg?
Here.
Ms. Diadamo?
Here.
Ms. Kennard? Mayor Leverage? Mrs. Reardon?
Here.
Supervisor Roberts?
Here.
Professor Sperling?
Here.
Dr. Tellis? Supervisor Yeager?
Here.
Chairman Nichols?
Here.
Madam Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Dr. Balmes was particularly sorry not to be able to be here, but he is at a research conference. I believe it's in Chicago, and he was out of the state. We got word from Dr. Tellis yesterday that his schedule as a physician prevented him from being with us today. And I know that Mayor Loveridge is planning to join us later this morning. So we do have a quorum, and more than a quorum, for this very interesting meeting. But before we begin, I have a couple of announcements that I want to make. Anyone who wants to testify, if you're not familiar with our procedures, should sign up with the staff that are in the lobby outside the auditorium. And we request, but you're not required to include your name on the speaker card. We're planning on observing our three-minute time limit as usual today, although, given the rather relaxed schedule that we're on, we may allow a little bit of indulgence in that area. I also have a great pleasure and privilege this morning of recognizing one of our own board members for an accomplishment which she probably wishes we weren't going to mention the number of, but we have a board member who has actually served the state of California as a member of the Air Resources Board for 20 years, and this is her 20th anniversary of her having originally been appointed to the Air Resources Board. And so being a state agency, we don't have anything exciting like gold watches or anything like that. But we do have resolutions, and we very much wanted to honor this occasion. So I'd like to actually read this resolution, and then I'll present the official version of it. The resolution is as follows, and it's resolution 11-1, because it's our first resolution of the year 2011. Whereas, on the occasion of February 8th, 2011, Mrs. Barbara Reardon reached an impressive and unprecedented accomplishment of serving 20 consecutive years on the California Air Resources Board. Whereas, during this tenure, Mrs. Reardon served with unequaled commitment to improving air quality for the citizens of California while faithfully representing her constituents in the San Bernardino region. Whereas, Mrs. Reardon has effectively represented the interests of small and mid-sized air pollution control and air quality management districts within California. Whereas Mrs. Reardon has served 4 governors, 7 board chairmen, and with 35 board members and 4 executive officers, wearing them all out as far completely. I added that. providing sound and well-respected advice and counsel to all. Whereas Mrs. Reardon has also been appointed as an interim or acting chairman of the board 3 times, each time ensuring that the board's commitment to clean air and a healthy economy continued uninterrupted. Whereas air quality over the last 20 years has improved dramatically in all areas of California, whereas the board's programs are often emulated worldwide, resulting in improved public health and higher focus paid to such issues as environmental justice and land use, and whereas Mrs. Reardon has earned the respect of her peers and the broad range of stakeholders that interact with the board through her calm and graceful manner, her common sense approach to improving air quality while considering the impacts on the economy of the state, and her unparalleled ability to empathize and communicate with affected businesses and individuals. Therefore, be it resolved that Mrs. Reardon's fellow board members provide a heartfelt thank you to Mrs. Reardon for her years of exemplary service and longstanding commitment to improving air quality for the people of the great state of California, presented, et cetera. I believe this resolution is endorsed unanimously by all of my fellow board members. So thank you very much,
thank you,
Barbara.
Thank you. That's very good. I had hoped to sort of stay under the radar and not have to recognize the number of years, only because I'm a lady and we never like to acknowledge our age. Just to let you know, there are two chairmen seated in the audience. They still hopefully speak to me, Bob Sawyer and John Dunlap. Hopefully, Chairman Nichols, I didn't go through so many chairman by choice. It was more of a happenstance. But I just want to say how much I appreciate the fact that I have been able to serve all these years and to have had a staff that is totally outstanding. And I think those of us who serve on this board really need to say thank you to the staff that really do the work for us. We sometimes get the recognition, but we really need to recognize them. So I'm very happy to accept this. Don't want to recognize all those years, but do want to say thank you to the staff and to my many board members. And we've had some wonderful years and some wonderful board members. Some of them have been real characters. Those have all been in the past, not today. Not today.
Oh, right.
But many in the past have been wonderful characters that I thoroughly enjoyed serving with. So thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And speaking of the staff, I do also have for you another plaque. This one actually comes from our staff and is beautifully prepared. And it recognizes you for reducing 640,000 tons per year of air pollution. So take that.
Take that. Thank you, staff. Well, that's just a credit to them, too. That's a lot of pollution, my gosh. And so when anybody asks me what I've been doing for the last 20 years,
you can point to your, point to your flag.
Thank you very much.
And then last but definitely not least, I believe we also have a presentation from CAPCOA, which I'd also like to speak.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm Ken Koyama. I'm the new executive director of CAPCOA. Earlier this month, passed a resolution also for Barbara Reardon, and I'd like to read it if I may. The resolution from the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association, whereas Barbara Reardon was appointed to the California Air Resources Board by Governor Pete Wilson in 1991 and reappointed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2004, and whereas Barbara Reardon has worked tirelessly to implement ARB's mission of promoting and protecting public health and welfare, and whereas Barbara Reardon has served as a member of the board for the California Air Resources Board for 20 years, and in doing so represents the longest consecutive appointment tenure in the history of the Air Resources Board, and whereas Barbara Reardon has been a prominent proponent of the reduction of statewide mobile source emissions for countless numbers of ARB regulations over the years to reduce such emissions and improve air quality throughout the state, and whereas the CAPCOA Board of Directors wishes to honor Barbara Reardon for her longstanding contributions to improved air quality, resulting in more healthful air quality conditions for tens of millions of Californians. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association hereby recognizes Barbara Reardon for her distinguished 20 years of service to the ARB and her leadership, dedication, and commitment to the cause of clean air in California, and expresses the association's appreciation through this resolution adopted February 11, 2011, signed Thomas Kristoff, President of CAPCOA.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Barbara and I have a little rivalry of statistics going on here. I haven't served as long as Barbara has on the ARB, but I have been appointed 3 times and twice by the same governor. So. And Supervisor Roberts here has a little bit of statistical distinction, too.
Earlier this morning, completely unrelated to this, Barbara and I were talking, and she just casually threw out a reference to 2020. And when she said it, I was thinking, there's not many people around who would even know what she's talking about. And we're not talking about the TV show. But it was the old building that we were in many years ago. And she was wondering if it was still unrented. Or maybe somebody knows that.
I don't know.
But I think because of her attempts to train me over 16 years, and maybe her longest reigning project on the Air Board.
I guess you can't leave, Barbara.
I would say that with affection and respect, because the work she's done, especially when she has weighed in on an interim basis on those periods where we didn't have someone of experience to chair the board, she deserves a lot of credit and recognition.
Absolutely.
And, of course, as a county supervisor for many of those years, I'm always appreciative that she would have done the dual duty here.
Whenever I hear about people, thank you, I agree with you. Whenever I hear about people who are making a career and a fortune in crisis management, I think about people like Barbara who's done it for years without making any extra pay as a result of doing it either. It's a really remarkable service.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we do actually have a board meeting today. I just want to say a word about the schedule. We are going to take a break at sometime around the noon hour and have an executive session today. And we intend to be done by 2 o'clock because there is an executive officer hearing taking place in this room at 2 o'clock. Is that correct? I mean, if it started a few minutes late, it wouldn't be the end of the world. But it can't start before that, right? So that is the plan. Okay, so the first item before us this morning is a joint meeting with the members of our research screening committee, and we're very pleased that we've been able to welcome some of the members of that committee to our meeting. ARB's research program has been an integral part of our mission from the very beginning. And the research that we ourselves have sponsored, although it's only a part of the scientific basis for our programs, has provided some very key information that has been integrated into our work. Today's meeting is an opportunity for the board to engage with the screening committee in a discussion about our priorities and themes for the future. Our research interests are shared by many other state, local, and federal organizations. And in fact, the reason why Dr. Balmes is not with us today is because he's attending a U.S. EPA workshop on multi-pollutant risk assessment, which is an issue that has been very close to his own personal research agenda and is of great interest to the board as well, since we're well aware of the fact that people don't breathe one pollutant at a time, and yet our tools for regulating air are very focused on individual pollutants. The kind of opportunity that Dr. Balmes is engaged in today is critical to our efforts at the state level because it enables us to leverage our very limited research funds through influencing the research priorities of other agencies and institutions. So I want to extend my thanks to all of the members of the Research Screening Committee, and a special thanks to those who've been able to travel here today to participate in the discussion. I am aware of the fact that the members of this committee spend many hours reviewing research proposals and draft reports, and their input makes a critical difference in the selection of projects and in the quality of the final products of our research. So I'm going to ask James Goldstein to present this item, and then we'll turn to the discussion.
Thank you, Chairman Nichols. Each year, the board approves an annual research plan which reflects priorities in ARB's multi-year strategic plan for research. We last updated the strategic plan for research in 2003. Today's presentation will start with an overview of key research areas and findings from the 2003 plan. Then staff will suggest some topics for board discussion, but we also expect the board and RSC members to have additional ideas. To prepare for today's meeting, staff consulted with Dr. Baums and Professor Sperling, who helped us get this started. After the staff presentation, we'll open the discussion to the Research Screening Committee and members of the board. We are honored to have four members of the committee with us here today. I'd like to recognize each of them. First, Dr. Chung Liu from the South Coast Air Quality Management District, who's an expert in air quality modeling and technology advancement. Next is Professor Rachel Morello-Frosch from the University of California, Berkeley, who's an expert on environmental health and environmental justice. We also have Professor Suzanne Paulson from UCLA, who's an expert in atmospheric chemistry, and Professor Tracy Thatcher from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, who is an expert in indoor air pollution. Although not all committee members could be with us today, a conference call several weeks ago allowed them to contribute ideas which are reflected in the staff presentation. The chairman of the Research Screening Committee, Professor Harold Cotta from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, was planning to be here but was unable to attend at the last minute. However, he has provided a letter which each of you have in front of you. Dr. Susan Fisher of the Research Division will now continue the staff presentation. Dr. Fisher.
Good morning, Chairman Nichols and members of the board. We are delighted to meet jointly with the board and the Research Screening Committee regarding strategic use of ARB's modest but influential research program to support the board's decision-making and implementation. To set the stage for this morning's discussion, I'll present an overview of our previous strategic research plan, followed by some topics to consider as we move forward. The results of today's meeting will be used to update our strategic plan and will guide the development process for the next annual research plan. I'll begin with an overview of the previous strategic plan, which was originally developed in 2000 and then updated in 2003, serving as a roadmap for the past 10 years of ARB-funded research. The previous strategic plan identified four broad regulatory priorities as drivers of ARB's research program. First, gaining a better understanding of PM exposures, health risks, and emission reduction strategies. Secondly, characterizing and reducing community air pollution exposures. Thirdly, investigating how global transport of air pollution and climate change affect California's air quality. And fourth, promoting advancement and acceptance of clean technologies. In 1998, US EPA established the first PM 2.5 standards in the world. Research results that support protecting California's public health from particulate matter air pollution include studies that helped establish the biological mechanisms explaining PM 2.5-related premature deaths and contributed to new health protective air quality standards. ARB also funded studies that offer technical support for attaining strict PM 2.5 standards, as well as emissions estimates to support goods movement and diesel control plans. Currently, ARB is working with research partners to identify the most toxic species of PM 2.5 so that we can cost-effectively protect public health by targeting the most critical sources for emissions reductions. ARB is also engaged in research to verify the effectiveness of diesel emissions controls. Recognizing the goal of reducing exposures to communities near sources of pollution, Our research included studies to evaluate the impact of traffic on air pollution exposures and support land use guidance. We've also conducted research to clarify the impacts of air pollution on vulnerable populations, such as children, the elderly, and those with low socioeconomic status, who often are exposed to multiple sources. And we've investigated indoor exposures and sources. This indoor air research found high exposures to formaldehyde and ozone, prompting health-protecting regulations of composite wood products and air cleaners. Continuing research to support the understanding and mitigation of community air pollution exposures includes assessment of how neighborhood risks from toxic air pollutants vary in space and time, as well as studies of how ultrafine particles, semi-volatile compounds, and indoor air chemistry affect Californians' exposures to air pollution. These activities support our public health goals and also our commitment to consider environmental justice implications of air pollution exposures. Our year 2000 strategic research plan focused global air pollution research on the impact of air pollutant transport across the Pacific. In response to the signing of AB 1493 in 2002, ARB revised its strategic plan to include research related to climate change. With the signing of AB 32 in 2006, ARB's research portfolio further expanded. Research accomplishments under the previous strategic plan include quantification of impacts of Asian dust on PM2.5 in California. Also, field collaborations with NASA and NOAA gave ARB access to aircraft that collected data over the Pacific to inform boundary conditions for modeling. Multiple research projects provided direct regulatory support and economic analysis for the AB 1493 greenhouse gas regulations and AB 32 emissions reduction measures, such as several refrigerant rules. Several research projects projected future heat waves and air pollution episodes for Climate Action Team reports. Ongoing research related to global air pollution issues and climate change includes efforts to verify emissions reductions through mobile monitoring, networks of ambient monitors, and sophisticated modeling. To help inform the integration of climate and criteria air pollution control, ARB's highly leveraged collaboration with NOAA, the CalNEXT 2010 field study, has enabled investigation of the impact of air quality and climate change on each other. This research enables more effective planning efforts. Another key issue identified in the last strategic plan is promoting clean technology to enable low and zero emissions transportation and energy systems. ARB's contributions in this area include supporting demonstrations of efforts that led to commercialization of more than 10 clean technologies, including airport ground support equipment, control of boiler NOx emissions, and an electrically regenerated diesel PM filter. Ongoing state programs to promote clean air technology include the Carl Moyer Program, which offers grants to help Californians finance heavy-duty vehicles that are cleaner than required. Public Interest Energy Research supports energy services that are environmentally sound, reliable, and affordable. And AB 118 directs the state to invest in renewable fuels and vehicle technologies that are aligned with clean air and greenhouse gas emissions reductions. Now I'd like to introduce some of the ideas for future research areas that have been generated from discussion with the board members, the research screening committee, and staff from multiple divisions in ARB. ARB's regulatory responsibilities are continuing to evolve. As we move forward to meet these challenges, over the next 5 to 10 years, some issues that will face the board include integrating control programs so that we can meet both air quality and climate change goals, meeting long-term climate change goals, protecting human health by continuing to reduce air pollution exposures, evaluating the benefits of air pollution rules, and enhancing economic analysis. As we enter the next phase of strategic planning, it will be important to integrate our programs. In compliance with the Clean Air Act, the board has historically addressed exposure to criteria pollutants, one pollutant at a time. But since people are exposed to a mixture of pollutants, we will benefit by expanding health assessments to consider the effects of exposures to multiple pollutants. Controlling criteria pollutants as well as greenhouse gas emissions will require an integrated view of energy policy, land use, and transportation planning. We must also work closely with federal, state, and local governments to integrate criteria and climate control strategies. These partnerships allow ARB to leverage and enhance available resources and maximize efforts. ARB's research program can help form the foundation for effective policy decisions by filling critical gaps in the assessment of multi-pollutant exposures, identifying co-benefits of emissions reduction strategies, and supporting development of comprehensive strategies to put us on the path towards clean air in communities at the regional level and globally. While many programs are already in place to help us reach the 2020 greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals, the state has a longer-term goal of 80% emissions reductions by 2050. A strong program of federal climate change research focuses on national-level impacts and policies. However, potential cutbacks to national research programs may impede these efforts. California climate policy is moving quickly, and ARB needs to ensure that no matter what happens at the national level in the near term, we have the tools to meet our targets through options that work for the state. We need to confirm that mitigation strategies are working through verification programs. At the same time, we need to ensure that there are options to cost-effectively meet our long-term goals by focusing on research into emerging low-carbon energy technology and its viability in the state, and in coordination with other agencies. ARB will also build on our history of encouraging cleaner fuels by researching advanced fuel technology. Behavioral strategies will also play a crucial role in long-term climate efforts. Understanding behavior can help to ensure the success of technology-based mitigation strategies. Understanding behavior can also play a role in mitigation strategies involving the way we use energy, choose our housing, and travel. California's climate is already changing, so strategies to mitigate change through sustainable community design may benefit from tools that incorporate adaptation needs. A strong body of scientific research, supported by universities, federal programs, and other funding agencies, has established links between criteria air pollution and adverse health effects. Questions remain to be answered regarding, for example, mechanisms of ozone-associated premature mortality and risks from low-level exposures to hazardous air pollutants. Areas that warrant attention from the state's air pollution research program include quantifying regional, local, and indoor exposures and links between them, clarifying the role of ultrafine PM on exposures in the state, and identifying which pollutants are the most health damaging and which sources should be targeted for cost-effective control. As we work to attain increasingly stringent air quality standards, some of which require costly controls, it is imperative to systematically evaluate how well rules are working to protect public health. Several field studies in recent years confirm benefits of ARB rules, including studies showing that near roadway exposures are being reduced near ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach due to drayage, truck, and port rules. ARB has also worked on tunnel studies confirming that emissions control efforts are, in fact, reducing vehicle emissions in the state. In the coming years, we'll need to continue tracking our progress in developing new, cost-effective tools to measure results of our rules. Much of this work will be done through in-house research. For example, we'll develop improved technologies for ambient and near-source monitoring, modeling tools to inventory previously unrecognized sources, and better understandings of vehicle exhaust from new engine technologies and fuels. In addition to the direct benefits of our rules, we need to identify and account for co-benefits. ARB-funded research recently demonstrated such ancillary benefits by demonstrating that diesel emissions controls are reducing regional climate warming from black carbon. Another one of our priorities in the coming years is to ensure that we are using state-of-the-science methods in our economic analyses. One way we intend to accomplish this is with our new ARB Economics Fellowship Program. Starting this summer, we will have an outside academic expert serving as an in-house advisor for a two-year period. By the end of that time, we expect to have strengthened our ties with the academic community and incorporated the emerging thinking on economic analysis. There are three general areas where we would like the fellow to focus their attention. The first is looking for ways to improve our assessment of the economic impact of ARB's proposed rules on individual businesses. The second is developing approaches for conducting sensitivity analyses to provide a wider range of information on the impacts of economic cycles. And the third is to work with the broader academic community to assess whether there are any new economic analysis tools that could be used to support rule assessment. This will include looking for ways to broaden our analysis to include co-benefits and other potential outcomes associated with proposed regulations. ARB is proud of its 40-year legacy of research, but we must continue to strengthen our process and get the most return from our very limited research funds. ARB has a small budget of only about $5 million to $7 million per year to cover research ranging from emissions controls, atmospheric science, health and exposure, and climate change. Accordingly, ARB must focus its funds on areas with direct implications for protecting California's public health and continue to ensure that our research portfolio is substantially leveraged. Over the past 10 years, we have secured roughly $3 in external leveraging per dollar spent by the state. Leveraged funds include direct co-funding, in-kind resources, and access to facilities, equipment, and data sets. In addition to leveraging resources, returns on our research funds have been enhanced when they serve as seed money to initiate larger efforts. For example, the National Institutes of Health now funds the Children's Health Study, which was originally funded by ARB. ARB's research program, with its unique statutory responsibility to conduct air pollution research, has benefited from the lowest overhead rates available with California's universities. This low overhead ensures that our funds are used for actual research rather than administration, and it has been key to ARB's achievements. ARB, the Department of General Services, and public university representatives are currently negotiating whether ARB will continue to receive these low overhead rates for its air pollution research. ARB's research program provides the scientific basis for many of the board's activities, but also has a number of other valuable co-benefits. The vast majority of ARB's research funding goes to support researchers and graduate students at California universities. Many of these individuals become nationally and internationally recognized experts in the field of air quality, going on to serve in leading positions in academia, government, and industry. Also, ARB's research program has supported the development of a number of new scientific instruments and methods that have allowed us to better understand sources of air pollution and how to control them most cost-effectively. The combination of scientific expertise and technological development fostered by ARB's research funding has enabled the growth of many California companies involved in air pollution control and clean technology. Given the breadth of ARB's regulatory responsibilities and the very limited funding for its research program, it is important that the research program's influence extends beyond research that it can directly fund. We've already discussed several ideas internally, as well as with the board and the research screening committee. One key strategy will be improving accessibility of our research results to audiences that include researchers, regulators, and the lay public. We would also like to build stronger partnerships with air districts. Since many funding institutions and researchers would like to address policy-relevant questions, it is essential that we communicate our priorities to other funding institutions. We must continue to pursue research partnerships such as those exemplified by our CalNEXT 2010 collaboration with NOAA, and we will continue to target niche gaps that are critical to the state through dialogue with external experts whose larger research portfolios address many, but not all, of the questions facing the board. This summer, we'll bring the fiscal year 2011-2012 research plan to the board. The projects proposed by that plan will incorporate your comments today, and the overall portfolio will be guided by our ongoing strategic planning discussions. We would now like to turn the discussion over to the board and the RSC.
Well, thank you. Thanks for framing the discussion that way. It's very timely. I was actually surprised to learn that the strategic plan, which seemed to me to be fairly recent, was actually adopted in 2003. And even though I realize people have looked at it since then and there have been some tweaks made, I think it's very appropriate that we are undertaking a serious effort to now really reshape it in light of many changes that have occurred, probably the most significant one being, of course, the board's new responsibilities in the area of climate change. But that also opens up both opportunities and challenges to us in adding to the integration and partnerships all of those agencies that are funding research on climate change, which is a field that's way beyond anything we can take on financially or even in terms of keeping up with all of the work that's going on in that field. But it does become important for us to at least see where we can contribute and also to be in a position to better evaluate what's going on in that area. I would invite any of the board members who have any questions or thoughts along these lines to jump into the discussion at this point. I wanted to have this presentation today, both because it's the first time we've had a little bit of a lull in our agenda to be able to kind of step back and devote some time to just thinking and planning for the next few years. But also, I guess it's timely in the sense that, you know, within a new administration, there's always going to be some rethinking about priorities and agendas and so forth. When Governor Brown was running for the office of governor, he made some strong statements about his support for the universities and for research in the university. He's obviously facing some very serious budget constraints right now, and there's going to be challenges keeping his attention focused on the budget for months to come. But the more we can do to kind of focus and clarify our input on what we need and why we need it, I think the better off we will be in that process. So I'll start down at this end with Professor Sperling.
Well, I think the staff did a very good job of identifying a lot of the issues and priorities and how to think about going forward. And I have lots of more ideas, and maybe depending on how our discussion goes, I'll contribute. But I think the first thing I'd like to say is add a little more depth to, a little more context to what, how ARB has changed and its responsibilities and what that means for research. You know, when ARB got started decades ago, even before Mary, or even before chairman, and our 20-year board member, you know, the focus really was very different from what it is now. It's much more focused on very specific regulatory actions. It tended to be a little much more prescriptive than we do now, much more technology fixes. And we've evolved over time in many ways. So now our purview is much expanded with climate change, which requires a much more sophisticated, in a way, really a much more sophisticated approach. We need, the agency already is evolving towards more flexibility, more use of market instruments, more looking at multiple pollutant effects, looking at spatial impacts in terms of the effects on different local communities. So there's so many changes that have taken place, and even in the last 10 years, you know, even since 2003. And so as we think about going forward, given our limited resources, given the evolution of the Clean Air Act, or changes that are likely to be happening, and given how important California is in terms of the national discussion about the Clean Air Act, there's so much going on here and so little money. And so I think it really it does require us to think really hard about exactly what are our criteria about how we want to spend our money, what our needs really are. You know, one of the things I've learned coming from academia, you know, to the Air Board here is that in many ways, scientists and academicians really don't have a good feel for what the needs are of an agency like ARB, and ARB doesn't have a really good feel for how, you know, the academic culture. And there is this chasm, And I, you know, a part of that that's most important is understanding the how do you support, design and support regulatory initiatives and developing the models, the data to really support how ARB can move ahead in the most effective way. You know, we really have struggled, you know, SB 375, we've really struggled with, you know, many of, you know, our even our vehicle standards, which we've been working on for years. So, you know, this is kind of a general thought, but I think it would be useful to take a lot of those ideas that the staff just presented and really sharpen them up, have come up with very sharp criteria about what exactly are our criteria that we're going to use in designing our research agenda and evaluating projects, and what do we, and the tail end of it is, as was mentioned, doing a better job of marketing it and disseminating it, which is would be important for the research, important for ARB, important for environmental research generally. So those are general ideas. We can get to specific ones later.
Maybe just to follow up a little bit on your point, I know that within the university, within your university, there are multidisciplinary research entities that get together and try to plan their own future agendas, and one of the things they ask for often is our input into what they should be doing. I guess just to raise a question, is there some more effective way that we could be integrating the information across a number of different entities and disciplines to help us think more strategically, as you suggest? Because I should say one of the things I learned during my time in academia is just how incredibly competitive the process of getting research funding is. Anybody who thinks that, you know, professors just sit there and grants roll in and they get to work on whatever they feel like has never spent any time at all around a university where, particularly in the sciences, but I presume it's true in other areas as well, the top researchers have to devote a very large amount of their time to actually putting together and getting the funds to do the work that we're talking about. So here comes ARB with a small amount of funds but a large need. You know, is there some way that we could better take advantage, if you will, of the fact that it is a very competitive world out there?
You know, one little thought on that is I think more interaction, and maybe the research committee will have some thoughts on this, but, you know, my experience is that I am, given my experience here in Sacramento, I am able to go back to university and talk to researchers and explain to them what really, how they could tweak their research a little bit, you know, in a ways that can be much more useful and productive. I mean, part of it is just them understanding what our priorities are. And maybe, you know, part of this is just putting a little more effort into having, you know, James or John Balms or myself and others actually go out and talk more at the different universities, because I think, you know, researchers love to, they want to do research that has an impact. We have the great advantage here is that what we do is very compelling to them. And so maybe, you know, part of this might be just more actual physical interaction and communication in the universities. But maybe some of the research committee members might have some thoughts.
I would invite any of you to respond to that. I'll call on my friend and colleague, Suzanne Paulson, since she's sitting right in front of me.
Okay, I think that, you know, I guess it would be great if you guys could come and make presentations and so on, but I think that communication could be done effectively in writing as well, or, you know, with websites and so on. even I've only been on the RSC for a couple of years, I think that it's fair to say that I don't have that clear of an idea of exactly what your research agenda is, and I've been trying to triangulate, you know, in my experience as a new RSC member. There's a little bit of guidance in the research call that goes out every year, but it's quite vague. And, you know, this does have some advantages because it draws a lot of very novel ideas. And if you're more prescriptive, then you won't get as broad a collection of sometimes very good ideas, and maybe not take advantage of the very wide range of knowledge that's available in the academic community as well as you have been in the past. But I think that working on communicating better your priorities would serve pretty well, and it probably can be done in written form fairly effectively. What?
Other thoughts on this general line of whether there's a better way for us as a board to be communicating our priorities to the academic community? Okay. Chung.
I think it will help, definitely, that some direct communications at university levels, and particularly most of the funding from the ARB research division does go to the university systems. On the other side of the equation is that ARB, given a small research resource available, I think it's probably annually on the $5 to $6 million actual dollar. But ARB does have a heavy mandate and has a lot of influence on a lot of research projects outside ARB. So I really strongly encourage the board, the staff, and research division really heavily involved in the participation, coordination, and even try to influence the other research program at the national level, at EPA, DOE National Labs, and some of the trade organizations, research program. I think ARB really tuned into, but needs really getting more like the National Institute of Health and CRC. Those organizations have done marvelous research work, and we really can take advantage. Like what I say, ARB has a name, has a mandate, and people listen. So you can really have a heavy influence way beyond this $5, $6 million. That's something I want to point to.
So being able to free up some of our staff who have the appropriate expertise and training to participate in some of these efforts, as well as tapping into the board members who are able to participate, would be a good way to expand our reach there too, right? Yeah. Okay. Other board members have any questions or comments at this point about where we go from here? Ms. Berg?
I would just like to echo what the direction of the conversation, and also looking at the first 40 years has really been about the low-hanging fruit and going up the tree, and I see that the struggle that we have now is the solutions that we have in front of us are A, not inexpensive, so they're very expensive, and B, they affect a wide range of the population, and so we're going to get some backlash on that. Mm-hmm. So in looking at our research, I was thrilled to see that we were looking at some behavioral areas and also some economic impact, and I would encourage that on the economic impact that we bifurcate and look at impact on existing populations or stakeholders, as well as economic impact on creating new green jobs and so forth, and that we are able to communicate that. I think what we've learned over the last couple of years, both with AB 32 and some of the diesel rules, is that lumping all the impact study under one umbrella made people feel like, A, they weren't being listened to, and it had a great impact on them. And so I think as we're going forward, some of the research would be well served if we could keep in mind that the things that we are going to be looking at are not easy answers, and instead of putting one umbrella over it, to look at it from different avenues. And I think that also could be very helpful to us. Great job today. Thanks.
Mayor Loveridge.
What I'm going to say, I was not here for much of the presentation, but just two quick comments. So one is the question of priorities. Of almost the more you do, maybe the less you do. That is the question if there really are important things that we need to know about, it may be important to identify and commit our sums to that as opposed to a wide range. And so that's probably been discussed many times before, but I think the issue of priorities and funding limited rather than many, at least, is a question. The other is just on the economic analysis. I came in as you're talking about an economic fellow. I was trying to understand, mm-hmm. what is that? That's a senior.
It's a postdoctoral fellowship for actually someone who's recently received a doctorate, but who's moving into an academic career. And the idea is that the person will be based at the university, but will be working here a portion of the time. And part of their responsibilities will be to help link us to state-of-the-art research that is going on in economics.
And how will that fellow be chosen?
Somebody can explain in more detail probably than I can how we've actually set this thing up.
Yes, this fellow is being recruited by the University of Santa Barbara, and the position is currently being advertised, and the interviews will begin at the end of March. The initial interviews will be conducted by University of Santa Barbara staff, the PI, and then ARB senior management will be involved in that interviewing and decision-making process because the individual will have very close contact with the chair and with the board members.
Nothing against University of California, Santa Barbara, but why Santa Barbara as opposed to Davis or Riverside or some other campus?
UC Santa Barbara has a very strong economics program. They have existing links with ARB, and one of the priorities in establishing the ARB Economics Fellowship was to do this quickly because we felt this was a priority. And so we're taking advantage of our existing very strong linkages with UC Santa Barbara to expedite that process.
But I believe they're disseminating this opportunity and trying to recruit candidates from throughout the system.
Statewide. That's correct. Statewide. This is not recruiting simply Santa Barbara graduates. The position is being advertised in economic journals on a widespread basis, and so in theory the applicant could be coming from anywhere in the country, and we're very much pushing and advocating for a very high quality, high caliber candidate to take this position.
I think starting a couple of years ago there was interest on the part of some legislators, and I think if there were more money around we might have gotten further with this in actually creating a position for a chief economist at the ARB because of the heavy pressure and questioning all the time about the effects of what we do. And as the board members heard many times over the course of the last couple of years, we have some excellent staff and very well-trained people who are also in communication with academic experts who are thinking about the latest ways of evaluating the kind of work that we do on the economy, pro and con, because it does become very adversarial at times, as several people have pointed out. That never really came to fruition. But this seemed to be something that we could do internally to identify a position for a postdoctoral fellowship. Fortunately, those aren't quite so expensive. And the idea was that if somebody came for 2 years, that would be enough for them to make a real contribution here and also would enable us to begin to establish a cadre of people in the economics profession who know more about how we think and what we need and what we do to help bridge that gap that Professor Sperling was talking about, where, you know, people in academia oftentimes really don't understand how government approaches issues like pollution and what we can do about it. So anyway, it's an experiment. But
the only other caution, it seems to me, it would be helpful if they were from California itself, one of the universities, to have somebody from pick another state. Doesn't seem to me to match what our needs were and attempt to tie back into existing state research.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, California is an expensive enough place to live and work, and the salary that we're offering is low enough so that I don't think we're likely to attract candidates from far away who would have to move here just to take this. But you don't know, because certainly since the advent of AB 32, we've seen a real surge in interest, graduates and experts from all over the world in wanting to come and work with us on some of these issues. And it's going to probably be continuing at least for the next couple of years in the absence of a strong federal climate program as well. Anyway, that's helped us, I guess, in some respects.
Madam Chair. Ms. Reardon. Yes, I'm very excited about I'm very excited about this economic analysis and how we move forward. I think that's going to be a real benefit for me as a board member. I also, when we were discussing opportunities, it occurred to me to partner, as we have in the past, for research has been very helpful. And I'm looking at Chung Lu and thinking with South Coast on occasion, and hopefully we can continue to do that. I don't know what your budget is now for research at South Coast. At one time it was a very healthy budget. I don't know what's happened to it today. But there are many opportunities to, you know, work with people such as South Coast Air Quality District, and there may be, you know, many others, and we need to try to do that as best we can. And Chung, are you our liaison between the two, ARB and South Coast?
No, I'm here being a member of the research screening
committee. No, I know you are, but this would be a subset of your official position today. I mean, you must carry the message on occasion back about what we're doing, and hopefully you're telling us what South Coast is doing.
We have a clean fuel funding, so we do have some resource can be used for mobile source related, particularly the vehicle related projects. As a matter of fact, that a recent major study we're initiating is to check the emission in the real world, the so-called in-use emissions from heavy duty vehicles, and the ARB has. Staff is helping us to select the contractors and consultant work on it, and we just received a letter also. They are going to send four staff to work with us on the steering committee. So those kind of efforts have been ongoing for many, many years, and will keep on going. And besides the South Coast on the national level, and part has been engaged with NOAA, NASA, I mean, those organizations have heavy mandate also to look into the atmosphere, and the study last year is tremendous success. So those kind of efforts are ongoing. And for South Coast, we'd be more than glad to really work with CRP on all the research projects related to mobile sources.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Just to put on my local government hat and maybe sort of some other issues to look at with the research. I know that cities and counties and even MPOs continue to struggle with SB 375 and the sustainable community strategies. And I just want to make sure that we spend a little bit of time looking at how to help out cities trying to particularly measure many of the land use decisions that they're making. They too are totally understaffed. They aren't quite sure what they need to be doing, and they certainly don't have any idea of how to sort of measure what their actions are. And so I think that's very important to make sure we have contact with local government and find out what kind of research would be most useful for them. A lot of them are coming up with their strategies, but again, they aren't quite sure of knowing what's going to be, what's going to produce the type of results that they're looking for. Just some other issues, too, that are going on around local government. As we look at the air quality, particularly amongst in areas where there's a lot of freeways and a lot of industry, that is often the areas where land is cheaper and we can build more affordable housing. But the clash there is between the air quality and the housing. And I don't think local government really has a very good idea of how to measure that air quality. And so even though we're looking at more EIRs and they're certainly showing that these might not be optimal places to house people, if they're not in sort of the central areas where all of the freeways and the mass transit is, it's going to be a little hard to figure out where to place those that housing. The other thing, too, is to look at sort of behavioral change. I think as we're looking at trying to have people move into the central city where there's more transit opportunities, it's still going to be difficult to get people out away from living into more suburban areas or trying to get industry and companies to locate in urban areas rather than on the outskirts. And so what do we need to do to sort of change behavior so we get the results that we want, so we have the fewer miles traveled, that we really have that concentration in the urban core rather than, again, building outside of the urban areas, all of which has to be done if we're going to meet the goals of SB 375. But again, I can tell you that the cities really are in the dark. I think they want to try to comply, but they aren't sure what they're going to do that's actually going to be effective, and so whatever ARB can provide them. And I should say the same thing is true, I think, with the air districts and with the MPOs. Again, they've set the targets, but no one is quite sure how they're going to achieve them. So any assistance that you can give them, I think, would be very helpful.
We're going to be talking about this topic a little bit further this morning, actually, when we get into the SCAG report. But it's fair to say that as I've been out and around in the last year or so, this is a theme that I've heard quite consistently. And we have made some commitments at ARB to try to help leverage funds to work on exactly these issues that you're talking about. There is more going on than maybe meets the eye at the moment, but we have succeeded in getting some funding directed from bond monies that we don't control but that exist to direct into this area at the MPO level to improve the state of the art of monitoring and modeling, in particular, for impacts of changes in land use and transportation on greenhouse gas emissions. And we are all looking and appreciate, everybody's help in finding pots of money and research programs that can be leveraged in this area. So one of the ones that I've been working with, I'm on the advisory board for the PEER program at the Energy Commission, which is funded with money from ratepayers of investor-owned utilities. And some of their funds, we are hoping, are going to be able to be used for this purpose as well. And it's a large pot that's potentially available. So there is recognition of the need that you're talking about. This is also an area that Ms. Diadamo has been interested in for a long time, and how we get better messages out to local governments and land use agencies about the impacts of their decisions on air quality.
Yeah, thank you, and I couldn't agree with you more. I have seen the reports about increased funding, and I think it's terrific, but Supervisor Yeager makes a very good point, and I'm seeing that everywhere I go in the Valley. All I could say, just to add to this, is that anything that can be done to make it very easy for municipalities, there's a whole area of actions that can be taken that are just very subjective. I just met with staff yesterday, and they were talking about making bus stops more pleasant so that people want to ride the bus. Well, that's something that communities probably want to do anyway, but they can't really wrap their arms around what does that mean in terms of a reduction. So as you were talking about housing near freeways, very specific information that just makes it easier for communities to determine as they plan and grow what specific actions they can take where they can see a measurable result.
I'm also pleased to notice that we have an expert in indoor air quality serving on our research screening committee, because the issue about where and how people get exposed to air pollution, the amount of time that people are actually spending indoors versus outdoors, and, you know, what, if anything, we can do about indoor air quality is one that is always kind of bubbling along just below the surface, I think, of, you know, the regulatory attention. It's not an area, other than in our effort that we undertook a couple of years ago to get rid of the kind of indoor air purifiers that were actually making air worse for people. We haven't had much activity in that area directly, but as people who are concerned about air quality, it definitely behooves us to pay attention to where the air is that people are breathing. I don't know if Dr. Thatcher, you want to comment at all about any of the work that you've been doing with the committee, but be interesting.
I really appreciate your interest in indoor air quality. I appreciate your interest in indoor air quality. I think it's really important, and I think it dovetails to a lot of the things we're talking about. It's hard to regulate indoor air quality because there's not really an authority, but a lot of the things that you do impact indoor air quality. And a lot of the things we're going to do for greenhouse gases, changing fuel types, wood-burning stoves, a lot of the outdoor regulations also impact indoor air quality, and it's important to understand that connection mm-hmm. between the two. So I think there's a lot that can be done and that should be done. A lot of the behavioral issues that we're talking about, a lot of the greenhouse gas things are going to be the lowest hanging fruit is implementing behavioral changes and understanding what the what impedes those. And a lot of those end up being strong impacts on indoor air quality, and there may actually be some indoor air quality drivers that can help people go towards behavioral change mm-hmm. when they understand that if they make changes in their fuel consumption and the way they run their house and things like that, not only is it good for the environment, it lowers their utility costs, but it also can change their indoor environment and make a much more healthy place. So I think there's a lot of places where indoor air quality can dovetail nicely into the regulatory framework and the things that we're trying to achieve. And I try and include that or help the understanding of that as we work on processes.
That's very helpful. Thank you. I'm going to call on you too, Dr. Morello Frosch, just to maybe add a few comments. I know your work we have had some interaction, and you've been involved with the ARB's work in the area of understanding impacts of some of our regulatory efforts on environmental justice and trying to create better understanding on our part as well as part of communities about how our work affects communities that are most impacted by air pollution. So maybe you might just add a few words from your perspective about how things are going in that area as well.
Yeah, well, I just would love to dovetail a little bit on Supervisor Yeager's points about municipalities and local communities thinking about land use planning, transportation planning, because this is an area, I think, where impacted communities, particularly environmental justice communities, are really working to engage on those issues. And so I think any research that can kind of help inform the rollout of a lot of those policies where local communities and regions are trying to achieve climate change goals are going to be key to get community buy-in on those issues if we are going to really impact those behavioral change goals that we're seeking to promote and encourage. Mm-hmm. So I think that research that promotes kind of interagency partnerships, whether it's the Energy Commission or the Department of Public Health, or even partnerships with non-governmental organizations and research and policy think tanks that are really thinking about these local and regional community impacts and measuring sort of exposure reductions, potential health benefits, and their distributions, I think is also going to be very critical, and that this research plan is really some of these ideas that have been sketched out today in the presentation, I think kind of promotes three basic issues: improving the scientific rigor about how we assess both costs and benefits, and doing a better job at assessing benefits and co-benefits and their distributions. Making sure that the research is relevant to what communities are dealing with now, both municipalities and local governments and regions. And then I would say the reach of the research. How do we think a little more strategically about how we distribute the results of the research that we funded in innovative ways that are more accessible to diverse audiences? So I think there's some ways in which to do that dissemination strategy to reach broader audiences. It doesn't necessarily have to entail a huge cost, because I know we're all under pretty severe budget constraints.
I think that's great. I would just add, I know it was alluded to in the staff presentation, but I do think that particularly when we're talking about local governments and how to communicate effectively, that bringing the air districts into that discussion could be very productive. I don't know if any other districts in the state have the kind of resources or well-established research programs. I'm not as familiar with others outside of the South Coast. There may be, but South Coast certainly has a long-established program, and if we can also help take advantage of their resources and their connections at the local level, particularly as we get more involved with SB 375 implementation and are really trying to provide technical tools to the local governments to use in assessing their land use and transportation plans. I think that could be a very effective collaboration. One more comment here. Thank you.
Perhaps let me offer a few cautionary notes. So I'm, of course, very enthusiastic about doing more and better research, but, you know, speaking on behalf of my colleagues, research colleagues, you know, we have many, many ideas. We're by nature it's a creative community, and let them loose and they'll come up. They could spend billions of dollars on very useful research. But, you know, it really, so that's one cautionary note. The other cautionary note is that we have to be able to anticipate, by the nature of this process, priorities in 5 years from now. You know, by the time you come up with your priorities and let the contracts and research is done and you get it back, you know, you're talking 4 or 5 years. And so that's a lot trickier. That's a lot harder. I mean, we can sit here and say, well, cities need this. Yes, today that's what they need. What will they need in 5 years? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a hard, you know, so I think we need to pay attention to that. And so I just had a few summary thoughts, you know, as I was listening to discussion. And a lot of this, well, it all repeats what was said, but I think synthesize it. I think we need, you know, one point is we need to sharpen our criteria about what we really want to fund and need to fund, given our limited resources, you know, in terms of regulatory needs, in terms of leveraging, in terms of the science gaps, you know, that's number one. So what are those criteria, and be more specific about it? The other is to articulate much better what are these science gaps as we're going into the future. What are these regulatory needs that we are going to have in 3, 4, 5, 8 years from now? We also, I think we need a better process for getting advice as our agenda has broadened and the questions have become more complex. You know, the economic fellow is a good idea, but I think we can probably, you know, figure out other ways of doing that. You know, maybe we have specialized research advisory committees in different areas that can help us, and that can be relatively cheap. You know, we have to figure out how to do all this, you know, with relatively little money.
Cheap isn't good enough. It's got to be free.
And with our new governor, we have to be even cheaper, right? And then, you know, this idea of dissemination, I mean, I really, you know, I've been talking to staff about it, and it's echoing what's been said here. But, you know, in this modern day and age when, you know, the world is awash in different kinds of information, we need to do a much better job of disseminating our findings. And, you know, one of the ways of doing that might be using our research staff more as kind of research synthesizers than as project managers, so that they can take some of this knowledge, like on multiple pollutants and their effects, or on the effects on cities, and, you know, SB 375 co-benefits and so on, and synthesize it and be key parts of the process of putting out white papers. You know, you can use science writers are useful, but, you know, a lot of the research staff are very good writers, and maybe they can, you know, play a role in this. But somehow I think we need to do a better job of, you know, it's so important. You know, I mean, if no one knows about it, no one reads it, you know, what good is it? And it's, you know, communicating those research findings, you know, given the nature of the public discourse on science generally and so many of the things we're interested in is really degenerated, and perhaps ARB can play a positive role in, you know, upgrading that discussion a little bit.
Does anybody else have any sort of concluding remarks? I would just want to perhaps add one thing to that comment, because I agree in general with all you said. And that is just to remind all of us that there's a lot of work that goes on at ARB, both internally and externally, funded through contract dollars that would qualify as science or research, that takes place throughout the organization. And we're really only focusing on that one small part of it that is used for external, peer-reviewed academic research. And that is kind of it's a separate pot of funding, and it's also a very special kind of program that we have. We're one of a small number of agencies in the state of California that has anything like this program, and it's something that we've nurtured through the years, because it does provide us with a seed funding to participate in a much larger world of ideas and of longer-term thinking than what we can do with our day-to-day regulatory programs and needs. It is important for all of us to understand that this kind of research cannot be looked to give you quick results. You cannot contract for, you know, through research grants. You're not going to get a cookbook or a report on the time frame that you need it, because it's just not, it's not going to happen that way. So what we're really doing with these dollars is investing in people and programs that will provide us over the years with the expertise and in some cases even the people. So I appreciate your comment about better ways or in other ways to get advice, and I totally agree with that. I would just say, perhaps because it was my idea to begin with, so I have to defend it, but the idea of the fellowship for an economist was really based on the fact that there were so few people that we could find anywhere in economics departments or with PhDs in economics who knew anything about our programs or, you know, had any interest in participating in some of the stuff that we were facing. So we'll see if it works, and I realize that it may not. But I do think it's important that we recognize that there is a much wider world of communications and interaction that we need to have with the science community and with the public at large than we can possibly do through this program. But I think it was useful to shine a light on the research program itself, because it is a venerable program, and it's one that we have to continually defend as, you know, over the years as something that we need to keep going here to provide us. I think it's, as Dr. Fisher's report mentioned, work that has been sponsored through this program over the years has played a big role in the reputation that we do enjoy internationally and for our efforts, and so we want to maintain that if we possibly can. If there are no further comments, I will thank the members of the screening committee for having taken the time to come and being willing to respond to our questions, and appreciate very much your efforts, and hope to see you again. Thank you very much. Good luck with your planning process. We will now move to some specific research proposals, but I guess before I do that, I should ask if there's any public comment just on this item of the research report. Okay, seeing none, we will then take a break. And, well, we won't take a break. We'll just move right into the consent calendar, which consists of 17 research proposals, which were part of the 2010 to 2011 research plan that was approved last October. These projects were developed with the current program priorities in mind. And since we just concluded this discussion of the planning process, I would point out that several of these projects involve research themes that we intend to pursue going forward. So I would ask the clerk of the board whether we have any witnesses who signed up to testify on this item. We did not. If there are any board members who want to remove any item from the consent calendar, then we would remove them from that. Otherwise, I would ask that we vote on the resolution, on the resolutions, and approve them all as a whole. Yes.
I just need to recuse myself from. There's a number of them that are UC Davis.
Okay. If you want to just note that for the record, make sure that the clerk knows that you didn't vote on those. On those items. So otherwise, we can have a motion to adopt resolution numbers 11-2 through 11-18. Okay, second. All right, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right, any opposed? Great, thank you very much. Thanks to the staff for a really good job of organizing that effort. Okay. The next item is a report from our executive officer on what he's going to be doing in 2011. It's on the ARB's 2011 priorities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Nichols. Today I'm going to give an overview of the activities planned for this year and the items that we plan to bring to the board in 2011. This year's focus is primarily on implementation of programs, given the number of significant rulemakings we've promulgated in the past few years. This year's primary focus is on implementation of rules to reduce emissions of pollutants that form particulate matter and ozone, toxic air contaminants, and emissions of greenhouse gases. We have one major rulemaking this year, that's the Advanced Clean Cars, and several modifications to existing rules to address various implementation issues. I'll also touch on our activities in Washington, D.C., and joint activities with our partners at CAPCOA, and talk about the 2011 board calendar. Governor Brown is emphasizing the need to develop California's green economy and new jobs and to provide for a clean energy future. These priorities reinforce the need for the programs we are implementing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve air quality statewide. I'll start the discussion of program implementation with a list of measures to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. Key program implementation areas include the Renewable Energy Standard, Low Carbon Fuel Standard, Cap and Trade, Refrigerant Rules, and Development of Sustainable Community Strategies under SB 375. While SB 375 is being implemented by local agencies and metropolitan planning organizations, ARB staff will be reviewing the technical documentation related to greenhouse gas targets set by the board. Implementation of the Federal Clean Air Act involves a number of programs in order to meet planning and regulatory requirements and to achieve air quality standards. This list of programs focuses on our efforts to reduce air pollution at the statewide, regional, and community levels. A variety of rules that have already been adopted are reducing emissions from goods movement statewide and near ports and rail yards. In addition, we have an initiative focusing on rail yards this year, and the 2010 on- and off-road diesel rules are being implemented as well. Enforcement of ARB regulations is always a core implementation activity to ensure that expected emission reductions are achieved. And lastly, there are substantial information technology activities which underlie all of our programs. I'll start the implementation discussion with our efforts to increase California's use of electricity generated from renewable sources. Currently, we are awaiting action on two bills going through the state legislature, SB 23, and another part of the budget special session that would another bill included in the budget special session that would require investor-owned utilities and publicly-owned utilities to acquire at least 33% of their electricity from renewable energy sources by the end of 2020. Meanwhile, staff is completing revisions to the renewable electricity standard as authorized in the board's adoption of the rule last year. As directed by the board, staff will evaluate options to harmonize provisions of the proposed RES regulation with the California Public Utility Commission's a tradable renewable energy credit program. The interagency coordination on these issues has been unprecedented and is being done through the Energy Principles Group, which is helping us to integrate our greenhouse gas efforts with California's energy policy. This year, the implementation of the low-carbon fuel standard starts. Energy providers regulated under LCFS are now required to reduce the carbon intensity of their gasoline and diesel fuels. Throughout the year, staff will be performing technical analyses, developing new tools and methodologies to support the program, and participating on stakeholder work groups established by the board. In a parallel effort, the LCFS Program Review Advisory Panel held its first meeting here last week. This panel will assist us on the formal review of the LCFS regulation. All of this work will feed into recommended regulatory amendments that will be brought to the board later this year. We anticipate adding fuel pathways. In fact, today we're having our first executive officer hearing to consider several new fuel pathways, and new land use change values, as well as other amendments developed with the assistance of the advisory panel. We will also update the board on our progress to develop and incorporate sustainability provisions. As part of the work to finalize the cap and trade regulation and implement the program, ARB staff will begin to hold a series of workshops to discuss offsets, electricity, allocations, and compliance. Later this year, staff will provide an update on the allowance allocation system, the status and schedule for the market tracking and auction systems, an update on market oversight and readiness, a status report on offset protocols and supply, and information regarding the Western Climate Initiative overall. While there's still a lot of work to be done before the cap and trade regulation takes effect, staff is up to the task as California continues to lead the nation in this area. I'd also like to thank Kevin Kennedy, who is leaving the Office of Climate Change shortly for a new position as head of U.S. climate efforts at the World Resources Institute in Washington. I know that I sent a memo to all of you. I don't know if Kevin's here.
Yep.
There he is.
Kevin, so thank you, Kevin. Yeah. He will be missed, but luckily, we work with WRI a lot, and so we will see him quite a bit.
Yes, I consider them part of our staff, don't you?
Yeah, I don't think he's actually being released.
Exactly.
But he'll be in Washington, which is great. All right, next slide, refrigerant rules. Two other greenhouse gas regulations take effect this year. The refrigerant management program requires best management practices to reduce emissions of refrigerants from commercial refrigeration systems. The regulation, of course, is designed to reduce refrigeration leaks. Also effective starting in January is the automotive refrigerant can recycling program for do-it-yourself automotive refrigerant cans. This program involves manufacturers, retailers, and the end users of small refrigerant cans. As you'll recall, this is the program where we worked with the industry to redesign the can and to have a return deposit. So we're expecting great success from that program. And, of course, we're coordinating with the local air districts to conduct outreach and enforcement of these rules. Much of the activity related to developing sustainable community strategies will take place at the regional level, of course. The San Diego Association of Governments will be the first metropolitan planning organization to include a sustainable community strategy as part of their regional transportation plan in summer 2011. Other regions will follow in 2012 and 2013. We are providing technical support and working with other state agencies to identify funding mechanisms, which is, I'm sure, something we'll also be talking about a little later. In the goods movement area, we recognize the
that reaching our future air quality and public health goals will require a collaborative effort across a broad spectrum of agencies and stakeholders to transform California's diesel-based freight transportation system into a much greener model that relies on zero and near-zero emission technologies. We hope to initiate a discussion about the logistics, infrastructure, and technology improvements to deliver a more efficient system that cuts fuel consumption and greenhouse gases, regional ozone and fine particles, and localized health risk. In the meantime, we continue to implement the goods movement rules for ship fuels, cargo handling equipment, transport refrigeration units, drayage trucks, harbor craft, and shore power in order to reduce emissions. Ports are applying now for Prop 1B grants to co-fund installation of shore power and will complete these projects by 2014. These measures are currently providing significant reductions, although staff will propose some revisions this year to improve compliance or regulatory flexibility. ARB continues to pursue diesel emission reductions in the rail yard and locomotive sector of goods movement. ARB's voluntary agreements with the state's two major rail carriers remain in effect and continue to reduce emissions near railroads, rail yards. These agreements are expected to reduce PM emissions and health risk by 85% between 2005 and 2020. Last June, staff provided an update on the proposed commitments to reduce diesel particulate matter at the four rail yards. And in January of this year, staff posted revised draft commitments to address the board's June 2010 directives. These revisions are designed to increase accountability and encourage deployment of new technology. For the diesel truck and off-road equipment rules, staff is completing the board-directed changes from the December board meeting and will be issuing the revised regulation for 15-day comment period for the 15-day comment period later this year. We developed an extensive outreach program to assist with compliance of the diesel rules. The outreach program will provide small businesses and fleets with information about multiple regulations, ranging from the idling limits to retrofit and modernization requirements. And we hope to reach about 300,000 truck and equipment owners about available funding opportunities. This multifaceted program includes meeting with industry work groups and outreach efforts to fleets, dealers, and repair facilities. In addition, we plan to hold about 50 one-stop outreach efforts statewide, where we provide truck and equipment owners with information about the new requirements and the funding opportunities in person. Next slide. To achieve our clean air goals, we need to combine efforts of regulations and incentive programs. Incentive programs complement regulations by providing funding to achieve early or extra emission reductions. Later this year, staff will propose a new funding plan for the AB 118 Air Quality Improvement Plan, which tackles the issue of providing incentives in the context of significantly increasing volumes of electric vehicles. The board will also consider new guideline proposals for the Carl Moyer Program in April to expand opportunities for fleets. Board Member Berg has been instrumental in leading the Incentive Programs Advisory Group that provides a forum for discussing policy-level issues relating to these air quality incentive programs. CAPCOA also plays a critical role in the development of the incentive program policy guidelines and the development of the overall programs. Meanwhile, the Proposition 1B Goods Movement Fund, which started at $1 billion, has received approximately $460 million from bond sales so far. Currently, the majority of the Prop 1B dollars are being allocated for truck and shore power projects, and we anticipate getting additional funds from bond sales later this year. We'll continue to look for additional funding sources to support clean school buses. We'll also continue to implement our other programs, such as the Heavy Duty Loan Guarantee Program with the State Treasurer's Office, the Car Scrap Program with the Bureau of Automotive Repair, and over a half dozen different federal awards that the board has received. This year, we expect the state implementation plan efforts to start ramping up as we prepare for upcoming air quality planning issues and implementation of new air quality standards. Staff is preparing a response to EPA's proposed disapproval of portions of the 2007-2008 PM 2.5 SIPs submitted for the South Coast and San Joaquin Valley. Staff has submitted comments into the record and is preparing additional analysis and information that support approval actions by US EPA. These analyses will be presented to the board in April. Staff is also developing the technical tools needed for the next round of PM2.5 SIPs, which are due in 2012. These include preparing an update to our mobile source emissions model known as MFEC. Anticipating air quality planning issues that we will confront in the coming years, we are commenting on the proposed new 8-hour ozone standard and proposed changes in EPA's implementation of Clean Air Act requirements. Staff is also evaluating and taking into consideration recent court decisions that could significantly impact future air quality plans. With regard to enforcement, our goal is to make sure that we achieve the expected emission reductions and to ensure a level playing field for the regulated community. Last year, we moved about 40 cases of direct regulatory violations by fleets. We inspected over 13,000 pieces of equipment and issued about 3,000 notices of violation. Our enforcement program, particularly in the context of the number of new rules that we've promulgated in the last several years, is constantly reevaluating its deployment of resources and prioritizing because, of course, we don't have nearly the number of resources we need to enforce the program like we'd like to, so we are targeting our efforts where it makes most sense and where we can use our resources most efficiently. Our enforcement program also conducts training and outreach efforts that is widely applauded across the state and across the country. The training provides both formal classroom and hands-on instruction to address a broad audience. And among other benefits, this training allows us to increase our partnership with the local air districts who often participate with us in these trainings. To conclude the discussion on program implementation, I'll highlight some key information technology activities which are critical to our day-to-day activities, even if they are a bit bureaucratic. This year's information technology priorities include the improvement of our project and data management process to address new state requirements and improve our ability to interact with our stakeholders. In 2007, the State Office of the Chief Information Officer was created and has now since been renamed to the California Technology Office Agency, and has been establishing policies that address all aspects of state information technology administration, from planning to purchasing. Our project management initiative is designed to comply with the project management methodology prescribed by the information officer for the state and the new requirements of a bill, AB 2408. I'm now going to switch from our implementation activities to the rulemaking proposals we'll be bringing to you this year. Most significant is the Advanced Clean Cars program, which will integrate our efforts to reduce both smog-forming and greenhouse gas emissions from cars, as well as the Zero Emissions Vehicle program. Staff is also preparing other proposed rules for the board's consideration. The Commercial Recycling Regulation, which the board will consider this spring, is a joint project with the Department of Resources, Recycling, and Recovery, formerly known as the Integrated Waste Management Board. Staff will also propose modifications to several rules that reduce air pollution from goods movement. Many of these adjustments are designed to address implementation issues through increased flexibility and consideration of the impacts of the economy. For the next two slides, I'll highlight the Advanced Clean Cars program. This program represents a coordinated strategy to address California's air quality and climate change goals. Using existing successful programs as a basis, the program continues progress towards our air quality goals by setting clear targets for 2025 and laying the foundation for the next generation of clean cars. The standards will identify a pathway to even lower emissions by mid-century. The new standards will integrate requirements for reducing smog and greenhouse gas emissions into the Low Emission Vehicle 3 or LEV 3 regulatory changes, giving auto engineers a clear target for meeting environmental standards over the next 15 years. The program will set performance-based standards building on existing and emerging technologies that will maintain consumer vehicle choice. As part of this effort, staff is continuing our close collaboration with the U.S. EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to establish national greenhouse gas standards for the model years 2017 to 2025. One goal of the program is to reduce criteria pollutant emissions to near zero levels for 2014 and later model years. For model years 2017 and later, we are evaluating greenhouse gas standards that would provide 3 to 6% greenhouse gas emission reductions per year through 2025. The third goal of our program is to require the introduction of commercial volumes of zero-emitting vehicles for 2015 to 2025. This is needed to achieve our 2050 greenhouse gas reduction goal. To ensure an adequate refueling infrastructure, we are participating in various work groups, such as the Plug-in Electric Vehicles Collaborative and the Fuel Cell Partnership. I'd also like to highlight our participation on the national front. ARB's criteria pollutant, toxic, and greenhouse gas reduction programs continue to lead the nation. Although the governor's office has reduced staffing in Washington, we have maintained a presence so we can continue to advocate for national policies that are support our programs and our goals. We continue to support U.S. EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, which is now being challenged as part of the budget-setting process in Washington. Some lawmakers are using the budget process to target the Clean Air Act waiver provisions for ARB's motor vehicle program. And as you know, the motor vehicle programs are the backbone of California's air quality program, and many states also rely on our standards. Our ability to seek and get waivers is therefore critical, and we're working as hard as we can to protect that. The EPA budget also supports state and local air quality programs, and the funding for those programs may also be in jeopardy. We're working with other states to ensure that Congress has accurate information about the effectiveness of the EPA programs as the debate goes forward. We're working with NESCOM, which is the Northeastern states, the State Voices Group, and we're also working with other research groups like World Resources Institute, Pew, and the Georgetown Climate Center. Next slide. Over the years, we've worked with CAPCOA and individual districts on countless programs and issues ranging from incentives programs to regulation development, enforcement, and responding to proposed rules by EPA. These longstanding relationships and partnerships have been instrumental in the successive outcomes of controversial rules and coordinated California's voice on national issues. We have a strong presence on the National Association of Clean Air Agencies. Finally, I'll provide highlights of the board's calendar for the year. For the months of April through July, we'll present SIP revisions, incentive program modifications, the commercial recycling rule, several rule modifications, and an update on the cap and trade program. For the months of September to December, we'll present the advanced clean car regulation, that's in October, potential cap and trade action sometime this fall, low carbon fuel, and other rule modifications. Thank you for listening to me this morning. We at the staff level appreciate the board's leadership, and we look forward to working with you for another year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. Thanks for the preview of coming attractions. The last 4 years for the Air Resources Board were a time of amazing productivity and also of a lot of pressure, I think, on all of us. I don't think I heard a single protest from a board member about the fact that we canceled the January board meeting. I think people felt that having a couple of days off was probably beneficial. But it's really good to know that the staff and you have been planning ahead for the coming year. And it's helpful to have, I think, that kind of an overview of what the year will bring. From an overview perspective, as you said, this is a year when a lot of what we're doing is implementation of policies and programs that we adopted over the last couple of years. But it's not just tweaking. It's serious issues that still have to be resolved or filled in. It's also a year when I think, as you've indicated, there's going to be pressures and reasons why we need the board members to help us, particularly when it comes to relationships with local governments and air districts, but also with all the constituencies that our board touches on, because clearly California is out there being viewed as being an outlier, if you will, on some of the issues that we work on. And we want to make sure that we're not just there because we like being alone. We're, you know, the idea is to be a leader because you are hoping to get other people to follow, and that means that your programs have to be seen as and genuinely be beneficial to the environment, to the health of the people, and to the economy as well. So we have a lot of work to do to make sure that that really is true. Lastly, I want to just underscore the fact that this effort on the next stage of vehicle emission standards is critical to the future of the board, as well as far as I'm concerned, to the future of the planet. Previous presentations have really highlighted how we have to transform our entire transportation system to one that is much closer to zero emission, not just of conventional pollutants, but of greenhouse gases, if we're going to have a hope of reaching our climate goals. And that's obviously going to require massive investments on the part of many people. This is not just something that's going to be done by Detroit or the auto manufacturers alone, or even by the auto companies and the fuel providers. It's going to take communities and businesses and electric utilities and others collaborating. So this is not something that ARB can do by itself, and it certainly isn't something that we would want to undertake without, if at all possible, a strong partnership at the federal level with the agencies that we deal with there. And we are working very hard. We've adjusted our schedule, as I'm sure many of you have noticed, to push back the date for us to consider any changes in our regulations in order to try to make sure that we and EPA and NHTSA are all able to use the same data and the same analyses of studies that we're working on together. This is a very big effort that we're in, that we're involved in, and it will once again, I think, bring a lot of attention to California in this area. It's also critical, frankly, I think, to the core of what this agency is about, which is our automotive regulatory programs, that we do this right. We're already seeing in the new Congress, and as part of the continuing budget resolution, an effort to simply take away the California waiver to pursue our auto emission standards. And while it's not something that we can do much about from here, it's something that our representatives in Washington, obviously, and the governor, in talking to them, are taking seriously and paying a great deal of attention to. So lest you think that this is going to be a quiet year, I just want you to know that there's more fun to come in the months ahead. We welcome at this point or as the year goes on, board members' comments, questions, concerns about how any of these issues are being approached. I guess it would be also useful to just say at the moment how happy I am, not only that I've been asked to stay as chair of the board, but that all of you are still here too. And it's as far as I'm concerned, it's been a great transition, and so we'll a vote of confidence, and we will carry on. Any comments about the presentation from the staff at this point? Yes.
I have just one, I think it's a simple question. Offset protocol. I keep hearing people talking about all these offsets and protocol development for it. What's the role of both, who's going to be approving those, and what's our role in, I mean, this could be a proliferation, right? There could be a lot of these.
Our focus is to work on protocols that meet all the conditions that a protocol needs to meet in terms of additionality and enforceability. Last December, when you adopted the cap and trade rule, you also adopted four sets of protocols. So only those protocols will qualify for compliance with the program. We are working on developing a handful of other protocols that eventually, when they're ready, would come to the board for consideration. But until then, there are no other protocols that we would accept under the program. But there are a lot of people talking about it, that's true, and we're engaged in some of those discussions at both the local, national, and in even the international level.
Well, we want to encourage those, right?
Yes, we do.
And what's the approval process? Is it the board? Does this go to the board, each of those?
Yes. So any new protocol, in addition to the ones that you've already considered and acted on, would have to come to the board for approval before it would be acceptable into the program.
And do you anticipate any coming up this year?
It's possible that there might be one or two that we could bring to you later this year. But again, these are, as you know, very complicated. And we're working also with our Western Climate Initiative partners on a series of protocols that all of the partners could adopt, which adds to the layer of challenge. But it's possible we might have one or two that we could bring later this year.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions or comments at this point?
If it's all right, I think Dr. Kennedy would like to say a few parting words. If he's still.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry, but we can't possibly spare the time. Welcome. And.
Or there might be some conditions, perhaps.
How about an offset here?
Ask him about offsets.
a little extra time.
WRI is going to do all the work, right?
That's right. Thank you, Chairman Nichols, Mr. Goldstein. I just wanted to express my thanks to the board for all of the amazing work that you all have done as the staff and management of the agency has been in the process of developing a overall comprehensive climate program in the last several years, more or less from scratch. The vehicle program, of course, was already moving ahead on climate issues before AB 32 passed. But a little less than 4 years ago, I joined ARB as part of the initial staffing up in order to be able to create the comprehensive program. I'm really proud of the team that we've been able to put together here at ARB, the working relationships we've been able to establish with the other agencies and with outside organizations like the World Resources Institute. But I think the seriousness and attention and time that you as board members have been able to take, as we have been very much on the leading edge, developing a cutting-edge program and demonstrating once again California's leadership, your work has been critical for this as well. And so I've been very proud to be part of this. I'm looking forward in my new position at the World Resources Institute. Part of my job is going to be working to find opportunities to support what states and regions are doing around the country, including California, but also finding opportunities for others to be joining as California leads. And working as well to try to make sure that we're laying a groundwork so that as we look forward to a future Congress, perhaps we can move back from playing defense at the moment to trying to be able to get something comprehensive going at the federal level. So I expect that I will continue interacting with many of you and with folks here at ARB. I'm really looking forward to the new opportunity, but I'm also very proud and very thankful for the opportunities that I've had to work in helping create the program that we have. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Kevin. You have, I think we can all agree, done an extraordinary job with shepherding the program to the point where it is today. And actually, I was only half kidding when I said that I considered WRI part of our staff, but WRI has, as a national organization, played a leading role in helping to shape the public awareness and to bring some very important analytical, technical support to the programs that we're now in the process of implementing. So it has been a very productive relationship, and I can only imagine that it will increase and become more effective with you in D.C. Of course, I do think that the board should take personal pride and credit in the fact that your work is what's led you to be offered this great position in Washington, and we would be very happy to take a percentage or a fee of, as a result of the, you're going to work for a well-funded organization. But in all seriousness, it is a very prestigious position that Kevin is going to, and well-deserved, and one from which I believe, in fact, he will be in a position to help us communicate well with other states and national organizations about what's going on here. So we're trying to accept this in a positive light and view it as something that's going to be constructive for us, and it certainly will be. And so we wish you the very best, and thank you for all you've done to make the climate program a success.
Absolutely.
Okay. What's next? Ombudsman, the report from the Ombudsman. Yes. We've asked for a report, and this is really this is a good opportunity, I think, to hear from LaRonda Bowen. LaRonda's been here for a year and a half. It seems like time has flown. And when she came, it was with a vision of making the Air Resources Board's Office of the Ombudsman one of the most effective in the nation by assuring that the voices of California's small business owners are heard and that their perspective is thoroughly integrated into ARB's decision-making. And she took that task on with great energy and enthusiasm. The Ombudsman's office is not just a place with a telephone that people can call. Under LaRonda's leadership, it has been proactive and responsive, really looking for opportunities to infuse small business thinking into our organization, across the organization, and into all of our programs, and to identify areas where ARB already is engaged in small business assistance, listening, and job creation to help build on and enhance and integrate those kinds of efforts. Under Ms. Bowen's leadership, the Ombudsman's office has reached out in a very effective way to environmental groups, local governments, and other public agencies to find common ground and new ideas for strengthening California's economy. So whenever I have had an opportunity or have had to cancel on an opportunity to go talk to organizations that represent small businesses, I've always known that I could count on LaRonda to go fill in, and the report back was generally, where have you been hiding this person? And great gratitude for the fact that we have her with us. So I'm very pleased to now turn this over to her and ask her to give us an update on what she's been doing. Do we want to have James, do you want to say a few words first? No. Okay.
I was going to say the same thing that you
said. Well, there you go. Okay.
LaRonda has done a great job of not only external outreach and communications, but also internally. I think she's helping change our culture to be more sensitive to the needs of the groups that she works with. So, LaRonda.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairman Nichols, and thank you, James Goldstein. Good morning, members of the board and also members of the public. 1 year ago, I presented the first business plan for the California Air Resources Board's Ombudsman, and I'm here today to report back to you on how we're doing with that implementation and what difference we're making. So I'll quickly review the mission and key functions of the Ombudsman and then share what has happened in the past year, including some of the results from our many collaborations. So you've heard a lot about collaboration, and that's really how we've been getting things done. I'll conclude with what we expect to accomplish over the next year and respond to any questions that you or others have. The Ombudsman fulfills an important part of CARB's mission, and the office supports CARB in achieving federal and state clean air objectives by ensuring that the perspectives of California small businesses and all stakeholders are integrated into CARB's policies, our regulatory processes, and our procedures. We act as a liaison between the regulated businesses and stakeholders and the CARB agency. So in a nutshell, our mission is to ensure a place at the table for all interested stakeholders, and we emphasize small business owners and operators because they're directly affected by our regulations and often lack the resources to participate in the regulatory process, and sometimes they're actually just fearful of participating. The Ombudsman has several key functions. The first one is to meet legal mandates for outreach, education, stakeholder engagement, and business compliance assistance. We also provide traditional Ombudsman functions of advocacy and problem investigation and, where possible, resolution. And we participate in policy development and implementation. The outcomes that the Ombudsman seeks in return for the investment of taxpayer resources are identified in these mandates. And we actively want to have more stakeholder engagement. So our legal mandates, the Ombudsman functions are mandated by federal and state law. It's not just something that we thought up one day. But Section 507 of the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments required each state and the territories to reach out to small businesses with compliance and technical assistance, including implementation and information in plain language. So our office was initiated to meet part of the requirement, other traditional partners in California and providing this kind of compliance assistance have been the local air districts. The Business Environmental Resource Group here in Sacramento is a longstanding business association that helps. Trade associations help. We work through suppliers. In 2011, CARB will form a group of business advisors to help us better understand how to engage and serve our small business owners. This is a task that we have agreed to do, and we're going to follow up on that this year. CARB Ombudsman is also linked in to a nationwide network of small business assistance providers who collaborate on compliance issues. We share tools and work to ensure the maximum utility of our limited resources. We share small business perspectives on regulatory implementation as well as on EPA proposed regulations with U.S. and regional offices. And we encourage small business participation in regulatory development. And we do this just as a group of 507 programs. So we're working that way. Other legal mandates, California government code has similar requirements for CARB's ombudsman, such as to receive and respond to complaints, and also various outreach and reporting functions. Most of California's environmental regulations have an economic and health consideration, as well as an environmental element built into them. So we're working with partners inside and out of government to find collaborative ways to achieve these objectives. You've heard a lot about collaboration. We are actively engaged with other Cal EPA ombudsmen, with the California Workforce Investment Board. In fact, there's a business resources catalog that will be up on our website, but it's a document that we helped fund for the so that business owners and operators could find resources statewide. So there's those kind of things. We're taking steps to remove barriers to greater cooperation among ourselves, and one example is this resource guide. So I'm happy to say that California has also a procurement goal that asks agencies to spend 25% of their contracting dollars with small businesses and 3% with disabled veterans. One of our small business contractors was spotlighted in the Sacramento Business Journal, helping with CEQA. So there you have it. We've actually helped them grow. We have 3% with disabled veteran business enterprises. Our Administrative Services Division manages this procurement requirement, and for 2009 and 2010, CARB slightly exceeded the goal for small minority business enterprises. The goal is 25%. We did 25.19, so a little bit more. We were just under the goal for disabled veteran business enterprises. They're getting harder to find for everybody, but the goal is 3%, and we achieved 1.5%. This on approximately $14 million worth of contracts. So last year, we exceeded the small business goal, and it was about the same for the disabled veterans. Another legal mandate that we have is found in the California Education Code. We coordinate compliance with the California Education and Environmental Initiative. Happily, in January of 2010, the State Board of Education approved the education K through 12 curriculum. So we'll have this. There's copies outside of all these things I'm holding up for others, but they're all available electronically. So this brings this program brings education about the environment to California's K through 12 students, and teachers receive free training on how to use this tool to teach science and history and social science standards to mastery. So again, a copy of this is available on the outside. In 2010, our focus was primarily on AB 32 policy. Fear and confusion over what the gradual shift to more sustainable energy sources and consumption might mean to California's businesses reigned. To their credit, your executive officer, James Goldstein, and your chair, Mary Nichols, directed the Ombudsman and the Communications Office to prioritize the development and implementation of an internal communications program that was designed to improve the transparency and consistency and the factual way that we communicate things. Although developed for AB 32, the procedures are now standard policy, including a checklist to help staff walk through the universe of potential stakeholders when they're thinking up any kind of outreach that needs to be done. Kathleen, who's one of our staff in the trench that works a lot with Sandra Berg, she's in the truck outreach, she's used this procedure, and she's been very good at actually making sure we consider all the stakeholders. So the fear of AB 32 encouraged CARB to show as well as tell business owners and others about ways to reduce greenhouse gases. So we thought the showing and telling mattered. We joined arms with other government agencies and private entities, including the Energy Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, and we looked to create and provide new tools for businesses, residents, and local government. Two legacy tools are the website http://coolcalifornia.org. I say that everywhere. I encourage people to just memorize it. You can use it. Local government, small business, everybody can use that. And the energy makeovers. For the very smallest businesses, CARB and Chair Nichols left the office, went directly to the field, and to small businesses with a multi-agency effort called energy makeovers. They occurred from L.A. County, Sacramento, San Diego County, Fresno, et cetera. The small business energy makeovers demonstrate the benefits of AB 32 to local communities. They're collaborative and have successfully shown businesses that they can reduce energy, save money, and make their business more sustainable, even if they're as small as a local beauty parlor. The Communication Office and the Office of Climate Change have taken the lead on these, but going forward, we intend to share this template more with others. So we're just going to do a quick little visual of some of the makeovers. There was the LA makeover. You can see all the partners, which included Southern Cal Edison, the county supervisor, the chamber, South Bay Environmental Services Group, and the city itself. There was one in Sacramento, Oak Park District and Stockton Boulevard, SMUD, the city of Sacramento, the mayor, and the water department. And there might also be one other familiar face holding up that banner. In San Diego, you might see a familiar face here. The North Park, Main Street, San Diego Gas and Electric, the mayor, of course, our board member, and the city council, and it was Sustainable North Park, a collaboration there. And in Fresno, finally, Fresno Fulton Mall in downtown, Pacific Gas and Electric, Energy Watch, the mayor, San Joaquin Valley Clean Energy Office, and the contractors, RHA. In 2010, when I talked to you for the first time, I made some commitments to you. I committed that we would identify a pool of small business leaders to help enhance stakeholder engagement. I said that we would identify ways to include economic opportunity as well as emissions reductions in our strategic thinking, and that we would work to ensure small business perspectives have a place at the policy table. We have, in many of these areas, we can report progress, but not victory. So we have definitely made progress. Are we all the way that where we want to be? No. We reached out to over 300 business associations during 2009 and 2010
And what happened as a result of that initial outreach is that in 2010, some of these people reached back to us. And they asked us to help them explain AB 32, and they asked for help with the on and off road rules, that we would help them explain these things to their constituents, and that's a big part of why we're here. CARB can't make a success of any policy on our own, no matter how beneficial it is to the public or to the environment. Unless we have the muscle and the wisdom of the business owners, they have to actually get behind what we propose. And so we stepped up to our commitment and strengthened our relationships with these stakeholders. And did you know that small businesses with between 1 and 20 people historically create more than 90% of all the new jobs? So we have reached out more to the very smallest businesses. And we've helped. We have to be sure that these companies, as well as those employing larger numbers, 100 or 200 or more, take advantage of the economic opportunities by the expansion of the new and sustainable economy. So we're learning from new partners like the Small Business Alliance in Southern California and the LA Industrial Council, the Forestry Association, and others. We've worked with the Sacramento Black Chamber of Commerce. We've reached out just across the board to stakeholders that haven't traditionally participated with us in many ways. We've reached out to broaden our and our stakeholders' views of the economic opportunity inherent in regulations. Ombudsman began monitoring and reporting on the California businesses who win small business innovation and research grants so that we know who's actually getting money to actually do the research, and we can support them and encourage them. And as Mr. Goldstein said, most Air Resources Board staff now ask themselves the question, how will this impact California small business? Whatever we're doing, it goes across the board. I think that this new consciousness, or this enhanced consciousness, is both timely and appropriate. So going forward, in 2010, we worked with a number of collaborators. In 2011, we want to continue to strengthen the partnerships and our relationships across all sectors, including becoming more knowledgeable about the diverse geographic regions that comprise our state. We also share many tools that were developed in partnership with others, and we believe that these collaborations are an efficient way to leverage our investments and our resources. So we're not trying to recreate anything. We're trying to leverage what already exists and strengthen what exists and then fill in the gaps. By closing some of the gaps that our stakeholders have identified, such as more adequate face-to-face interaction, we're looking at ways to use technology better, and multimedia compliance assistance, we're working more with all the other Cal EPA agencies. We also intend to increase the confidence of our customers that when they bring a problem to the CARB, it'll be taken seriously and resolved as expeditiously as possible. We can't always resolve everything, but we'll do it as expeditiously as we can. A final ombudsman priority, and really an agency-wide priority for 2011, is to monitor and reduce the number of third-party complaints by encouraging stakeholders to contact us first. We do listen, and for example, our board member Sandra Berg learned through the TRAC committee that some school districts do not have confidence that the retrofits can work for them, for example. So she has challenged the school districts and the retrofit manufacturers to join her in the field to find out what's happening and to make sure that the problems are resolved, clarified, identified, resolved. We invite all of our customers to share ideas on how they can engage how we can engage them more proactively. And as your ombudsman, I will continue to seek input from you and from all of our stakeholders in ways to achieve a healthy environment while maintaining and achieving a healthy economy. This concludes my report.
Okay, that's a lot for a very small office. I see you have your staff here also.
Right there.
Yes, there they are. Hi.
Four of them.
That's it.
We also have one individual and two students in El Monte, and they, working with the communications two staff or so that are there, have redesigned the entrance to the El Monte office. So if you actually come there, there's now a reception to welcome you. The students are still doing the hotline, but they're physically in a nice reception area. You don't have to sign yourself in and hope that somebody answers the intercom.
Makes a huge difference. Thank you. Questions or comments?
Can we introduce
yes.
Brian, please?
Hi, good morning, Chairman Nichols.
Hi.
And members of the board. I'm Brian Ehlers, Assistant Secretary for Education and Quality Programs with Cal EPA. And in reference to one of the slides that LaRonda introduced just a few minutes ago, the Education and the Environment Initiative, I wanted to come here this morning and to thank the board for your support of the EEI. Just in the last year, in fact, as LaRonda mentioned, the curriculum, all 85 units of science and social science, K-12, were approved by the State Board of Education, and now we're and wouldn't have been possible without your support. And we're now engaged in implementation statewide, where we hope to reach 6.2 million children. This is unprecedented. It's one of its kind, both in the nation and we believe internationally. And again, just wanted to come here and thank you for your support.
Well, thank you for coming and joining us. I have had a chance to look at the curriculum and a number of the products, and I really am impressed by the quality of this effort, and I know it's been well received. I gather there's an ongoing effort now through a private organization to help try to get the materials out there into classrooms. And if there are any board members who either personally are involved or know of people who are involved in organizations that are working with schools to provide materials that are useful to teachers and students, this is a very worthwhile effort.
Yes, please direct them our way. We're currently engaged in a four-year, $22 million effort to raise public private partnerships because currently there isn't the budget to get the materials printed and in the hands of teachers. They're available for free on the web, but please, through your staff, contact us if you have anyone who would like to support.
Thanks.
I'd like to thank Brian and his team, too, because they've been working with my daughter's fourth-grade teacher to try to get her the books and get into the school that my daughter goes. It's a really good curriculum. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's an incredibly arduous process to get materials approved for actual use in California schools. We are a very tough state to enter, and this is these are all products that meet California's very high standards for teaching to the basic skills that are required, and they're interesting and obviously very relevant. And from our perspective, although we too are, you know, we don't have any funds at this point that are left over to contribute to this kind of an effort, but I think all of us recognize that without an opportunity to get kids good information about the environment, they're going to be left in the dark as citizens in the future, regardless of whether they make their careers in this area. There's such a high degree of interest and so much information coming at people through all the media about what's going on in the environment. And the curriculum materials that were developed through this effort really will help people think about that information, organize it, and evaluate a lot of the noise that's out there in the world. So it's been a pleasure to have even a small role in supporting this. Thank you.
We very much appreciate it.
Okay.
I think I just had one quick comment that I would just like to thank LaRonda for her efforts. I've worked in a couple of stakeholder groups and small business groups, and I really do appreciate the year that you have spent. You have brought this department full speed. You had a tremendous challenge. It was part of the missing glue for us to be able to reach the stakeholders, and especially the small businesses. And I really appreciate yours and want to thank your department. It's been a great job. It's been a pleasure working with you. Thank you very much.
When LaRonda agreed to come and take this job, she promised that she wouldn't leave until she had cloned herself. So we intend to enforce that agreement. Any other questions or comments on this report? Are there any public members who wanted to comment on this item? All right, seeing none. We have one more informational report this morning. This is one that the board had asked for. It's an update on the regional greenhouse gas reduction target for the Southern California Association of Governments, affectionately known to all in Southern California as SCAG. And we will hear from our team that's been working on this item. This is another good news report, I think. So while they're making their way up here, last September, the board kicked off an important regional planning process to encourage the development of sustainable community strategies as envisioned in SB 375. The focus of SB 375 is on integrating land use and transportation strategies, which can be incorporated into regional transportation plans, which in turn leverage very important funds that are used for development at the local level. The board's role was to set the targets under this statute for the regional planning process, and we completed that task. It was quite an interesting journey, but it involved both the regional technical advisory committee on how to set the targets and a very extensive communication with the state's metropolitan planning organizations. The staff report today is a follow-up on the testimony that we heard at that meeting from SCAG, which specifically requested that we continue the discussion between ARB and SCAG on the feasibility of the number that we had assigned to them. I want to especially thank Mayor Loveridge for his leadership as a member of our board and the South Coast Air Board and the SCAG Board. In all three roles, he met with himself several times, but he also facilitated a number of other very important interagency discussions over the past few months. In all seriousness, this was a very important contribution that he made. So, James, you want to introduce this item?
Thank you, Chairman Nichols. When the board met last September on SB 375, we were directed to come back this month with a status report on our discussions with SCAG. That process is complete, and California is now in the implementation stage of SB 375. SCAG's Executive Director, Hassan Ikrata, has partnered with us on identifying specific funding and tools needed for successful implementation of SB 375 based on the recommendations of SCAG's Regional Council. Staff will discuss the progress made to date. Within the SCAG region, there are numerous ongoing efforts that demonstrate regional cooperation and positive steps towards sustainable community planning. In addition, SCAG is moving forward with improvements to its travel models, which the state has been able to support with Prop 84 modeling grants awarded by the Strategic Growth Council about a year ago. We will also update you on the timing of SB 375 implementation in other regions. The first regional transportation plan to incorporate a sustainable communities strategy will be San Diego later this year. We're pleased to see the progress being made in several regions as they move forward to develop their sustainable community strategies. This board has completed its task of target setting, and the MPOs are now doing the heavy lifting. But ARB continues to encourage collaboration and lend our support as needed to the MPOs. Ms. Terry Roberts from our Air Quality and Transportation Planning Branch will start the staff presentation. Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein, and good morning, Chairman Nichols and members of the board. This is an informational update requested by the board last September on discussions that have occurred between ARB and the Southern California Association of Governments, or SCAG, regarding SCAG's 2035 regional greenhouse gas target. This update to the board satisfies the condition set forth in the board resolution number 10-31 for a February update. No board action is required. This presentation will cover the following information. I will begin with a recap of the board's September 2010 direction to staff and report on the discussions that have taken place since. Next, I will highlight SCAG's Compass Blueprint projects, which are part of the region's sustainable communities efforts. I will provide a summary of the status of funding for SB 375 planning activities in the SCAG region, which will support SB 375 implementation. Lastly, I will give a short update on the status of SB 375 planning in other major regions. When the board considered targets for the 18 MPOs last September, you placed a condition on SCAG's 2035 target of 13% per capita reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from 2005 levels. The condition was placed on SCAG's 2035 target because of concerns expressed by the SCAG Regional Council that resource and other constraints could prevent the region from meeting the 13% target proposed by ARB staff. The Regional Council articulated its concerns by identifying 11 recommendations that would enable the region to meet its 2035 target in a sustainable communities strategy. These recommendations generally address the resource constraints faced by the region and the need for increased collaboration and supportive action from all levels of government, local, state, regional, and federal. The intent of the recommendations is to begin discussion on how to address funding and resource issues that will require collaborative solutions. In September, the board heard SCAG's concerns and directed ARB staff to continue discussions with SCAG and to report the results of those discussions in February 2011 at this meeting. Since last September, ARB staff has had several discussions with SCAG leadership and staff regarding the 2035 target and the Regional Council's recommendations. ARB staff continued to work with SCAG through the MPO Working Group, which meets monthly, and has also met separately with SCAG staff to further discuss their recommendations. Through these discussions, ARB and SCAG have come to a common understanding that the availability of funding and resources for transportation planning, infrastructure, and operations is one of the critical issues that will remain relevant to this and future target-setting processes. Both agencies agree that recent grant awards at the state and federal levels towards local and regional sustainable community planning are promising first steps towards addressing the fundamental resource issue highlighted by SCAG's recommendations. We also agree that continued collaboration will be critical to ensure these and other resources continue to be made available for sustainable communities development. At the February 3rd meeting of the SCAG Regional Council, the SCAG President, Mr. Larry McCallan, reported on the status of our interagency discussions. SCAG's primary concern is not with the targets themselves, which they do not expect will change and which they believe they can meet. Rather, SCAG is seeking assurance that ARB will again consider the Regional Council's recommendations when this board reviews and updates the regional targets in 4 years. The President also expressed SCAG's desire for ARB to participate with SCAG in funding their Compass Blueprint program. Based on this outcome of the discussions, the 2035 target, conditionally approved by this board, was affirmed. SCAG's request for consideration of its recommendations in future target setting is consistent with the board's intent as expressed in your September 2010 resolution. That resolution calls for an update every 4 years to review target implementation progress. This includes discussing the potential need to update targets to reflect the level of funding for transportation planning, infrastructure and operations, and other factors. ARB staff will continue to work with local, regional, state, and federal agencies and MPOs to track available resources for implementation of sustainable communities strategies. As I mentioned a moment ago, there has been progress on identifying and securing resources for sustainable communities planning. Since September, additional resources have become available to the SCAG region. State and federal dollars were secured last winter by SCAG and many of its local jurisdictions for sustainable community planning and transportation infrastructure that supports sustainable planning. At the state level, planning funds were awarded by the Strategic Growth Council. At the federal level, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and the U.S. Department of Transportation provided funds through the Federal Partnership for Sustainable Communities. And prospectively, ARB staff is working on an interagency agreement with SCAG to provide funding for three local demonstration projects. The interagency agreement that is under development would provide ARB funding to SCAG for several local demonstration projects which have been identified through the Compass Blueprint Demonstration Program. These projects were selected because they demonstrate the kinds of planning actions needed to make SB 375 implementation a success. The Compass Blueprint Demonstration Program is a SCAG program that for the past several years has funded a variety of sustainable development projects that are consistent with the region's vision for a sustainable future. These projects provide models for local governments to learn from and emulate. This year, the program will focus on projects that specifically reduce greenhouse gas emissions from vehicular travel. The response by local governments and other applicants to the Compass Blueprint Demonstration Program has been tremendous. In fact, this year's demand greatly exceeds SCAG's ability to fund. 63 applications were submitted to SCAG last October, proof of significant interest on the part of the region's cities, counties, subregions, and transportation agencies to plan and build sustainably and to help the region meet its greenhouse gas emission goals. But this level of interest also demonstrates a tremendous need for the resources to do it. The interagency agreement with SCAG would provide ARB contract funds for three of those 63 Compass Blueprint demonstration projects. These planning projects would be initiated this spring and be completed over the next 8 to 18 months. Each project would provide a model for three distinct aspects of sustainable communities planning. These three aspects include, first, to illustrate sub-regional sustainability planning, we would like to fund the Western Riverside Council of Governments Sustainability Framework Plan. The objective of this project is to develop a framework policy document that will be used to identify strategies for improved transportation systems, renewable energy generation and transmission, water and wastewater delivery, economic development, healthcare, and education. A specific goal of this project is to reduce vehicle miles traveled, in particular from vehicle trips out of the region for employment, health services, and other purposes. The second project demonstrates a reuse plan to transform existing development to transit-oriented mixed commercial and residential uses. This plan would include green building guidelines and enhanced Metrolink access. This project is the La Mirada-specific plan, which would establish a plan for reuse of existing industrial and commercial properties along the I-5 corridor. Specific goals of this project are to meet the city's regional housing needs with a mix of densities, reduce vehicle miles traveled, and contribute to regional greenhouse gas reduction. And the third project we would like to fund is the LA Metro Orange Line Bus Rapid Transit, or BRT, Sustainable Corridor Implementation Plan, which illustrates the aspect of transportation corridor planning. The objective of this project is to develop a plan for the 18 stations along the 18-mile-long transit corridor that extends from Los Angeles to the San Fernando Valley. It would ensure the design of new transit stations is compatible with surrounding uses and will maximize ridership through improved corridor design and connectivity to the stations through more walkable and bikeable streets. On December 3rd of last year, the Strategic Growth Council, SGC, awarded grant funds to several MPOs, including SCAG, for sustainable communities implementation work. The funding is from the first cycle of the Proposition 84 Planning Grant Program. SCAG was awarded $1 million to put towards their work on sustainable communities development, and in addition, 14 individual cities, counties, and one subregion were also awarded funds totaling just over $6 million for local sustainable land use planning. So this amounts to a grand total of just over $7 million in local implementation dollars to the SCAG region as a whole. MPOs as a group were specifically targeted for SGC funding to help them with SB 375 implementation. The total grant award to 11 MPOs was slightly over $7 million. That is $1 million for SCAG as an MPO and $6 million to the other 10 MPOs that applied for the funds. It doesn't stop there. The SGC is responsible for administering the competitive grant process for the distribution of over $60 million in regional and local sustainable planning grants. The awards last December represents the first cycle of funding from this pot of Prop 84 funds. Two additional cycles of funding are anticipated with the expectation that additional funding will be provided to MPOs and local governments over the course of the next few years. In addition, this past October, the Federal Partnership for Sustainable Communities began releasing local grants to support more livable and sustainable communities across the country. The partnership, which consists of the U.S. Department of Transportation, USDOT, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, awarded a combined sum of over $400 million nationwide. California communities received over $11 million of these funds. Communities in the Southern California region received nearly $3 million for sustainable communities planning. The USDOT awarded $20 million in Tiger II grant funds to the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority for the Crenshaw to LAX light rail project. These state and federal funds are promising signs of progress on the resources front, but we know that much more is needed. Now we'd like to bring you other news about what's going on in two key areas of the state, San Diego County, where SANDAG is currently drafting its sustainable communities strategy, and the San Joaquin Valley with its eight MPOs. In the San Diego region, SANDAG is making rapid progress on the development of its RTP, which when adopted later this year, will be the first RTP in California to include an adopted sustainable community strategy, and one that is anticipated to exceed its regional targets. SANDAG's 2050 RTP is intended to set the region's agenda for future highway expansion, transit, trains, trolleys, bike paths, and border crossings. It does this by considering a number of planning scenarios that project how fast and where the county population will be growing over the next 40 years. A number of public meetings have been held over the past several months, during which various planning scenarios have been discussed and considered by the public and the SANDAG Board. The preferred transportation planning scenario was selected by the SANDAG Board in December for incorporation into the RTP. SANDAG staff estimates that the preferred alternative will exceed the greenhouse gas reduction targets set by this board last September. Specifically, SANDAG estimates that their SCS will result in an 18% per capita reduction by 2035 as compared to the 13% reduction target set by the board. Work on the RTP is proceeding on a parallel track with the Draft Environmental Impact Report, or EIR. SANDAG is planning to publish the draft SCS/RTP in April, with the draft EIR being released shortly thereafter. Once public comments have been considered and incorporated into a final plan, it will be presented to the SANDAG Board for consideration this fall. An adoption of the RTP is anticipated no later than October of 2011. In the meantime, ARB staff is staying involved in the technical aspects of the SCS development process so that we can better understand the foundation for the greenhouse gas emission reduction estimates that SANDAG has developed. Last September, the board set placeholder targets for the San Joaquin Valley in anticipation of the availability of improved data and planning tools by 2012. The board recognized the need to work closely with the eight MPOs in the San Joaquin Valley toward this end. ARB board member Diadamo and ARB senior staff met with the San Joaquin Valley Policy Council on December 15, 2010, to discuss the ongoing work in the Valley related to SB 375. Both board member Diadamo and ARB staff committed to working more closely with the Valley MPOs as they begin their policy and technical work, which will be presented to this board at a 2012 target update. ARB continues to meet and discuss these ongoing efforts, both one-on-one with the Valley MPOs and at monthly meetings of the MPO working group. ARB continues to play an active role in the development of new modeling tools for the San Joaquin Valley. ARB staff is part of the team made up of MPOs, Caltrans, and modeling consultants that meets monthly as part of the Valley's model improvement plan effort. Several consulting groups are working on different modeling tools to help improve the Valley's technical capabilities, particularly to better quantify the greenhouse gas emission reductions, or excuse me, the emission implications of local policies. This work includes improvements to the Valley MPO's existing models for travel demand, as well as new activity-based travel, land use, and interregional travel demand models. Through this collaboration and technical assistance, ARB staff expects that the Valley MPOs will have the benefit of improved modeling tools that will enable better quantification of greenhouse gas reductions by the time these MPOs adopt their next RTPs in 2014. Now that ARB's work on target setting is done, the regions are taking the lead in developing sustainable community strategies and engaging the public in discussions about the future of their respective regions. SANDAG will be the first MPO to adopt an SCS, but planning is also underway in the SCAG and SACOG regions, which will adopt their RTPs in 2012. MTC will be the next in line to have a new RTP with expected adoption in 2013. By 2014, the San Joaquin Valley MPOs will be ready to adopt their RTPs. We see very promising signs throughout the state that at both the regional and local levels, there is a willingness and desire to move in the direction of more sustainable planning and development. This board has already expressed its commitment to support those efforts through technical assistance and identification of funding resources. ARB staff looks forward to working with the MPO staffs as they proceed with the important work of developing their sustainable communities strategies, important not only for addressing the state's climate change goals, but also to achieve the broader goal of livable, healthy communities. This concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. Do the board members have any questions about the report? If not, we'll turn to the witnesses who've signed up. We have four people who've asked to speak on this matter. The first is Robert Naylor from the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority. Mr. Naylor.
Chair Nichols, board members, I'm here for the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority. We are committed to meeting these goals, as witness being the first major transit agency in the country to eliminate the last diesel bus, as witness the adoption of an additional half-cent sales tax in 2008 to support transit and transportation in Los Angeles County. So we're now 1.5 cents of sales taxes for at least 30 years, and some of those are in perpetuity. But I do, notwithstanding all that, want to underscore the part of the report which focused on the financial constraints that we face for meeting these goals. We're very pleased that the governor's continuing transit funding in his budget that was restored to about $350 million a year last year as part of sort of the grand bargain. But we are now in the process, notwithstanding that and the sales tax, of cutting $100 million out of transit services to meet that much of an operating deficit shortfall. And so we are looking forward to state and federal help. We've pretty much put up as much local help as we can expanding transit service in the future. We're not going to be able to do it with current resources, and we're glad the staff report kind of tacitly recognized that. Thank you.
Thanks for that reminder. It's timely, that's for sure. Unfortunately, the same bad economy that's hurt our budget has had one positive impact, I suppose, which is there's been some reduction in overall greenhouse gas emissions due to reduced travel. So that's about the only comfort that we can take. Autumn Bernstein, on behalf of Climate Plan.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. Autumn Bernstein speaking on behalf of Climate Plan and also on behalf of the Natural Resources Defense Council today. We just want to thank ARB staff and board members, as well as SCAG staff and board members, for their leadership on resolving these issues. We think that the discussions that have occurred over the last several months have been incredibly valuable in identifying what kinds of programs, investments, priorities are going to be needed for on behalf of both the state agencies as well as MPOs to successfully implement SB 375 and harness the benefits of more sustainable communities. And we look forward to working with you, both you and SCAG, in the future as we move into implementation. Thanks.
Thank you. Bonnie Holmes-Jen from the American Lung Association.
Good morning still, Chairman Nichols and board members, and I am Bonnie Holmes-Jen with the American Lung Association in California, and I wanted to thank you also for resolving these issues, but thank you for your leadership in setting these targets last fall. It was a challenging process, and we all worked very hard on that, and we appreciate the good work that was done, and we look forward to the implementation effort. And I just wanted to underscore again that the public health community is very focused on this SB 375 implementation process as a key public health priority because of the tremendous ability to make a difference in reducing pollution, increasing physical activity, and reducing chronic illness And we want to work together with you as we go through this process to use the modeling tools we have and other resources to better quantify and communicate these public health benefits to local government leaders and the MPOs as we go through this SES development process that you've laid out. And, you know, we'd like to brainstorm further with you how we can better collaborate with you on that. We look forward to, of course, there's going to be a lot of emphasis on the SCAG region over this next year, and SCAG success is critical to the overall success of 375. And we fully support the efforts that you've laid out to help direct funding to the SCAG region and support pilot projects in that area, as well as, of course, to other regions. And we look forward to working with you again to emphasize healthy growth strategies and the importance of promoting active transportation, walking, biking, transit, and the transit-oriented development that you've laid out in the pilot project. So we look forward to any suggestions that you have about how we can better work together. We think it's extremely important to use all the modeling tools and the resources we have available to really clarify to the public the health benefits and other co-benefits that we're going to get with a strong implementation process.
Thank you. Connie Gallipoli from California Infill Builders.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Connie Gallipoli here on behalf of the California Infill Builders Association. Obviously, the California Infill Builders Association represents business and the development community, and they're very supportive of strong targets and feel that they're good business, make good business sense for California's economy. We're already, obviously, as builders, looking at the market, watching very closely market demand, and market demand has been looking for more options, more walkable and healthy communities and sustainable communities. And recent press has shown that multiple unit housing counts are up and higher than single-family homes as well, so that sort of represents the market demand. Many of the members of the association are already building projects that would help meet these targets. One example, excuse me, in the SCAG region is by Creative Housing Association is the Meridian Village project, which was sold out immediately in 2010. So in the current economic downturn, sold out immediately, and also reflected sales prices that were 26% above the average. So that, I think that right there says an awful lot. So I just wanted to, you know, reiterate that as a business and development association made up of many developers in California, supportive of high targets, I think it's very good business sense, while also will be helping California meet its climate change goals, as well as other environmental goals and sustainability goals for the state. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to come, and thanks to everybody for all the hard work that you're doing to make SB 375 a success. I think its secret is that it works with so many other goals that people have. It's not a new attempt to impose some new policy, but really to work with existing policies. Mayor Loveridge.
Well, thank you, Mary. Just very, very quick themes. First, thank you to the board for this opportunity to have a conversation between SCAG and CARB. I think this opportunity was well taken. SCAG is, as you know, 19 million people, 180 cities, 6 counties. We're a big place. It's much better to have SCAG as a participant and partner than it is to have as an adversary or opponent. I think I want to particularly acknowledge CARB staff. I think SCAG found the conversations not simply helpful, but they're respectful and were engaging and important. And so I thank very much for the CARB staff who participated. As reported back to me, they gave high marks to those conversations and obviously applaud the demonstration plans that have been funded. I mean, there are a variety of ways that I think regions are going to engage SB 375, a variety of tools. But as we move from plans to practice, one major difficulty that regions will have and cities will have is it depends on the fate of the redevelopment tool. Without redevelopment, the funding and resources, I think, get dramatically reduced. Complicate the objectives of 375. But the other just kind of comments, the one that Ron always makes too, is that this is 375. It's not something we wake up tomorrow and there will be a different day. This is a long process of changing to urban form.
Well, thank you. Yes, we're coming in on top of a lot of other discussions that are going on. I participated yesterday, no, the day before yesterday, in a forum at Cal Poly Pomona that had been called on SB 375 and its role and related issues about regional economic development. And I got an earful about the redevelopment concerns of local governments and, frankly, some comments that sort of opened my eyes because, you know, I'm a Los Angeles resident and I'm used to redevelopment as it has been practiced in that city. And I am familiar with what I would consider to be some of the abuses, frankly, of the system. And so that very morning there was a story in the LA Times which attempted to portray the harm that would occur if there was a change in redevelopment agencies, and their only illustration that they had was a minor league stadium, I believe, or a baseball stadium, football stadium. I can't even remember anymore. I think it was in San Diego. I apologize. It was a stadium, a park.
It was proposed minor league baseball stadium league baseball in the city of Escondido.
Correct.
Even whether or not that redevelopment is to continue,
right.
I think.
But I mean, it wasn't the kind of example that I think would cause most people to get excited and realize that there was something really at stake. So I am hoping that local officials such as yourselves who have the experience and those that I spoke to at that meeting who had some really compelling examples are going to be able to bring those forward.
Redevelopment is more than mermaid bars and stadiums. I think for many cities now, it's over time, they're really at, if you want good cities, it's hard for me to figure out how you get there without redevelopment tool.
Right. Yes, Dr. Sperling.
Down on the right wing here.
I never turn in that direction.
following up on the money issue, fiscal issues. First, I have a question. I mean, first, an observation. It's great that, you know, the relationships with SCAG and SCAG willingness to participate in this process. And, you know, having followed the RTAC process that led to this, it was really remarkable how most of the MPOs were ranged from perhaps ambivalent to hostile to this whole idea of SB 375 planning. And over time, as they became more aware of it, knowledgeable, there really was a dramatic change in the attitudes, and I think we're seeing that with SCAG as well. Now, having said that, I think the SCAG concerns about funding and resources is absolutely right on, and if this is all going to work, there has to be funding. So I have a little question and then a big observation. The little question is, this Compass Blueprint projects, what exactly, I mean, is this an AR, what is this? I didn't understand at all. I mean, there's a process, I understand, in SCAG, and then we're participating financially in some way. Is that it?
May I respond to that? The SCAG has a Compass Blueprint. This is a regional vision document that was prepared probably a decade or more ago. But to implement the vision on a voluntary basis, they provide incentive grants to the cities and counties and transportation agencies within the six-county region. So for the past approximately seven years, SCAG has initiated a competitive grant process whereby they solicit applications, proposals for different plans. It could be a new zoning ordinance, a general plan update. It could be a specific plan or a redevelopment plan, big or small. SCAG considers those applications for grant funding, and if those projects are good examples that demonstrate
the vision of sustainable planning in the SCAG region as identified in the blueprint, then those projects go forward. And ARB was invited to attend last year's, I believe Lynn Terry and I were both there for one of their one of SCAG's presentations on the award winners. We saw those as very compelling examples of how a region can incentivize local governments to actually move ahead with plans and policy changes at the local level that would help further a regional goal. So,
so how much money are they giving and how much are we giving?
The SCAG, I believe, has, and I don't know if I should really say this because I'm not certain of the number, but on the around $3 million, I believe, is what they think they can have available for this year's round of funding. And when I ask one of the SCAG managers, well, what is the total amount that's being requested? What is the total need here as represented by the 63 applications, I think it was on the order of about $20 million.
And our contribution to
and
this
is? Our contribution would be somewhere around $400,000 to $450,000.
Yes. It's less than $500,000 out of that. It, right. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket compared to an enormous need.
Thank you for that. Okay, so let me follow up on that point. Okay, so it is a drop in the bucket. And you know, for the kinds of things we're talking about, I mean, we're talking many billions of dollars. And so a kind of, both a question and an observation is, in the new DOT budget, you know, that the president put out, they have set aside tens of billions of dollars in for awards competitively in the, I'll put them in the category, the sustainability, livability, and to be rewarded to communities and regions based upon certain criteria, and you know, it's the idea is to be more performance based. So they're trying to move the federal government's trying to move more. Well, many people are trying to move them to more of a performance based approach to transportation funding, and the administration is clearly in line with that, and they haven't quite gotten that far, but they've set aside large amounts of the transportation funding to be awarded competitively beyond the formulas to support this these kinds of initiatives. And so the question is, you know, I don't know, you know, no one knows what Congress is going to do with those budgets, but there's clearly a movement in that direction which is perfectly aligned with SB 375, and it means a perfect opportunity for California and the MPOs and the cities to get huge amounts of funding. I mean, we're not talking millions, you know, we're talking many billions here. And so the question is then, how are we supporting or participating in this whole process, and what might we do if we're not to, you know, at both ends, both in Washington and as well as in the California side, on the California side working with the cities and MPOs, on the federal side working with Congress and DOT. Are there any?
Doug, do you want to weigh in here?
Sure.
And I would just make the summary comment. You know, this is the key to SB 375 being successful.
Right. You know, I think as we began the process for getting to the target setting point over the last couple of years, this concept of leveraging the work on 375 at the federal level was on the minds of most people throughout the conversation. Reauthorization of Safety Lou has been going on for a couple years now. And so as we begin to see some of the concrete potential happening at the federal level, our work at the local and the MPO level, just to get them in a position to be thinking about how their sustainable community strategies are developed in meeting 375 components, it'll feed directly into their positioning to be able to be competitive for those funds. If and when they become available.
Yeah, and I could just add that this is an area that Brian Turner is very familiar with, and he is working on our behalf. Senator Boxer has actually succeeded in getting a bipartisan House-Senate committee to come out to California to talk about this issue sometime in the fairly near future, and they were looking for testimony to be submitted. She will be a champion for us on this, but we do need to coordinate our efforts here and get everybody involved if we possibly can to make a really impressive showing on the need and how well the money could be spent.
Yeah, I just to reiterate, this is the number one thing that can be done, and I'm not even sure what the number two is that's so far behind.
Yes, Ken.
Yeah, just briefly, Terry, I'm still having a hard time understanding exactly what we're doing, what we're funding with these three plans. Is it to pay for planners to do the work so that these transportation corridors can be set to go, or is it research? And are what we're funding here going to be applicable to the other MPO so that they can use this information? And maybe at some point I could get more information offline from you on what exactly we're funding, but I'm still just a little confused by it.
May I respond to that?
Could I just say, in my judgment, these are projects that are internal to the jurisdictions have been identified. They're going to complete them, but this is more than simply funding three projects. It is an investment in goodwill, a statement of CARB. I think this is going to be heard very loudly. It is a very, very important statement that we're making today as we approve this.
No, I think that's great. I just don't quite understand what it is that we're approving.
The intent was that these would be actually models. That was why these three specific projects were chosen, was that it was believed that they could be applicable elsewhere. But you might just add a word or two about why that is.
And maybe I could add, because I think there's a real parallel here, and we've long had these programs to fund technology advancement demonstration projects, the ICAP program. Well, now we're moving into a whole new realm of funding demonstrations that are not pure technology. They're demonstrations of the kinds of strategies that it will take to meet the targets. And so we developed some criteria, staff, to say among the projects on the Compass list, which ones will be most broadly applicable statewide. And there is one of them was specific to the concept of sub-regional plans, which is a little unique to SCAG region because it is so large. And SB 375 specifically talks about sub-regions as a planning process. But the others, supporting transit development around transit station, that is meant to demonstrate a broad concept. And sort of to get at Professor Sperling's point, this has allowed California to be ahead of the game, so we can take things like these demonstration projects in the Bay Area. Steve Heminger has been sharing with us some work on accelerated introduction of cleaner vehicles into the fleet sooner than expected. Those are other kinds of demonstration projects that could potentially be included in this package. And then the idea of the planning process itself, that San Diego is first out the gate to develop a sustainable community strategy embedded in their transportation plan. It will be the first in the nation, I believe. So I think that's the opportunity we have in each of the major MPOs in the state of California over the next few months to pull together this package, what we're doing as a state, and then the unique opportunities within each of those regions. So that just this conversation is stimulating some ideas about how we can move forward to pull together our advocacy.
Okay, thanks. I think I'm going to draw this to a conclusion. It's obviously a topic of great interest to all of us. And I think what we should do is look for an opportunity, actually, to update the board about progress. I would say I appreciated the generally positive comments about progress in terms of providing modeling tools for the MPOs in the San Joaquin Valley. But 2012 is a ways off, and 2014 is a lot farther off. And, you know, if there's one place in the state where we have some hope of getting some planning done in advance of having to retrofit, it would be in that region. So I'd also like to hear a little bit more about how things are going in that part of the world as well. We have not set the targets there. We've punted. I mean, we say we've done our job, and we came up with a rationale for why we couldn't do it. But nevertheless, I am concerned that we're leaving out an important region if we don't keep an eye on it. And so if there's work that we can all do to be helpful, that would be important too. So maybe we can just ask for a report in 6 months or whatever to just get an update on how we're doing on implementation. That'd be helpful.
We could bring that maybe in September.
That sounds reasonable.
Okay.
We do have three people who've signed up for the public comment period. My feeling is that we should just do that now, and then we'll be done, except for the executive session, and we can come back and formally close the meeting and announce any actions which might have been taken in executive session after the lunch break. Okay. We'll turn to the public witnesses then. They are Michael Friedman, Patrick Berger, and Miguel Silva, in that order. And we have 3 minutes for each of you. Michael Friedman.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Chairman Nichols, Executive Officer Goldstein, and LaRonda Bowen, and members of the board. My name is Michael Friedman, and I'm coming before the board today to discuss a Stage 2 vapor recovery issue. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm representing a company, Easy Flow Nozzle. We are a California small business, and we are California's only Stage 2 vapor recovery nozzle manufacturer. And as a small business, we offer products to other small businesses who are the gas station owners. The issue at hand is on August 15th, the fire marshal ordered the removal of the hold open latches for the VST nozzles, suspending the health and safety code because the nozzle was seen as a dangerous health and safety and fire hazard. I'm just taking this opportunity today to inform the Ombudsman's Office and Mr. Goldstein that we actually have a very simple fix to this problem. It's a very simple part. It's I don't know if you guys want to see it. It's very, very simple, and it has to do with these springs here. And we would just like to inform the board that this is a very simple and cost-effective solution, and that stations that don't have these hold-open latches are being forced by VST to purchase a new nozzle for $200 to $250. And this side cap is actually has been approved on our pre-EVR nozzle that actually is the only pre-EVR nozzle that certified under the new standards of CP201, requiring nozzles to hang for 6 months, do a 100-car matrix, and require a 97% vapor recovery efficiency. And so we wrote a letter to the fire marshal informing him that our nozzle could actually replace the VST nozzle. But when our comments were forwarded to the engineering and certification branch, we were requested to send up some nozzles for an engineering evaluation. That was 6 months ago, and we've heard nothing back from the engineering and certification branch. We would just like to figure out the most cost-effective solution for station owners, because if it's something that's as simple as this little spring mechanism that can get hold-open latches put back on, not only do the station owners have a right to have nozzles with hold-open latches as the California Health and Safety Code mandates, but the customer pumping the gas has the right to not have to stand next to the nozzle in case there's some kind of a hazard that exists with that nozzle. And I'd also like to note that after inspecting the springs on the new VST nozzle at our factory, we've noticed that there have been some modifications to those springs, and which to us leads us to believe that VST is pretty aware that...
Go ahead and finish your statement there.
That VST is aware of this problem, and that we would just like to get our request certified in the same expeditious fashion that all the other gasoline nozzle manufacturers have been allowed to make modifications to.
Okay, thank you for that statement. I'm going to ask Deputy Executive Officer Caquette to follow up or to have somebody meet with you, and we'll see what we can do to respond to your comments. We appreciate it. This is an issue that we have been involved with, as you indicated. The fire marshal took the lead on the solution, but obviously we're very interested in the success of the program. So we will get back to you. If you've left your information with the clerk, someone will follow up with you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Patrick Berger from the California Public Interest Research Group.
Members of the board and Chairman Nichols, thank you very much. I'm a Berkeley student who is representing the Berkeley chapter of the California Public Interest Research Group, and I'm also in a class taught by a former chair of this board, Robert Sawyer, on California air politics. And so what I'd like to comment on today is the great necessity that it's in this year that we should significantly expand the zero-emission vehicle program. And I am very grateful that the board has scheduled October to be the month in which we determine how this should be done and to what extent. But I would like to comment on something that Professor Sperling brought up a little bit earlier, when he said that what's important is not just to consider our priorities now, but our priorities over the next 5 or 10 years and how things will change. And so I'm going to discuss a couple political developments over the last 2 years that have led this zero emissions vehicle program to become much more necessary than ever before. So first of all is Governor Schwarzenegger's executive order S-1408, which is the renewable portfolio standard, that instead of the 18% of renewable energy that energy companies producing in California currently produce at, by 2020 this will be increased to 33%, an expansion from the 20% mandate by 2010. The implications for this is that every single electric vehicle that we have on the road plugging into our grid by 2020 will essentially save twice as much energy because of the fact that the grid will be almost twice as clean. This means that any zero emissions vehicle program we start now, which will hopefully be to a significant expansion by this 2020 era, will have great positive effects even more than before. The second thing I'd like to talk about is the high-speed rail program. So the high-speed rail bill that was passed is slowly gaining steam as actually getting into the development phases. In fact, the deputy executive director of the California High-Speed Rail Authority said that by 2020, what would happen is we would have the first line of this high-speed train built going between Anaheim, Los Angeles, Bakersfield, Merced, Fresno, and my home, the Bay Area. So what this means is essentially that critics of the zero-emission vehicle have often stated that the consumer demand does not exist based on the fact that the range is often 100 or 200 miles or sometimes much less. This would remove much of the need for consumers to travel greater than that distances, since it would allow anyone traveling in this north-to-south direction, whether it's commute, vacation, or anything else, to be able to use this bullet train to get there in a matter of hours instead of taking a 6 or even 7 hour trip from Northern to Southern California. So it's with that that I ask the board to greatly consider expanding the Zero Emission Vehicles Program in October. Thank you.
Thank you for coming and for your comment. I think it's particularly noteworthy that your professor is actually sitting behind you in the audience. I don't know if he's grading your performance today, but I would encourage him to give you a good mark on that.
It was I very much
well
appreciate
done.
That. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, last, Miguel Silva of the Oakland Truckers.
Chairman Nichols, members of the board, thank you for the opportunity.
I'm sorry.
Is that better? Thank you for this opportunity to address you personally after your decision on December not to extend or not to modify the Dreyer's truck rule. I sent a couple letters, and I have not received a response. So this is a great opportunity for me to be able to address some of the issues that that were brought up at the time and to let you know how this is going to affect us in Oakland and in the Dreyer's truck business. I would like to address, actually, some factual inaccuracies brought up on the December meeting that led you to your decision. As I sat here, I heard Ms. Diadamo inquire about the number of trucks that would be affected and the locations where they would be affected. And the response from staff was to this question is that only 1,700 trucks in the Port of Oakland will be affected by the non-extension or modification of this rule. referring, of course, to those 2003 and older trucks that were retrofitted. In reality, out of the 5,800 trucks that serve the Port of Oakland, 4,400 trucks will need replacement by January 2014, not 1,700. Your discussion neglected to consider all the 2004, 5, and 6 model engine trucks, all which were led to initially believe that there would be a NOx filter available to upgrade their trucks and bring them in compliance to the second phase of the truck regulations. Now, we find out that those filters do not exist, and the trucks will need to be replaced. This will start at the end of this year with 700 trucks and 2,000 more next year, and, of course, at the end of 1,700 trucks that were alluded before. This will most likely put initially 2,700 truckers out of business. A second statement or a second question brought up was a reference that Ms. Nichols made regarding the potential health benefits of not adopting this modification, to which staff responded that the NOx benefits will be roughly 7 tons per day statewide. My question is, what does the board think where these trucks are going to go? Because unless there's a program where these trucks will be completely taken out of business, those trucks will be sold for on-road work, out of state, or even out of the country. So if NOx is a greenhouse gas, how is there a health benefit by selling these trucks to be continued to operate in other areas? Not only that, but if this is enacted as it is today, The 2004, 5, and 6 engines, I'm sorry, can I continue?
Your time is up. Can you finish up in just a few seconds, please?
Now, there's several other issues I wanted to bring up, but I would ask you to reconsider your decision. There's 4,400 trucks that need to be replaced by 2014. It is a monumental task financially for anybody in this business to be able to afford to replace these trucks. Staff believes, and I quote, that there are overriding economic and social considerations driving these proposed changes. The recession has significantly impacted the economic health of the regulated industry and consequently had greatly affected its ability to comply with the current regulation. Additionally, the recession has significantly social implications, causing a number of businesses to reduce their activities or go out of business.
Okay. Mr. Silva, this is what I'm going to do. We can't address your issue here today.
It's not
on the agenda. But I am going to ask the executive officer to write a response and to send it to all the board members specifically addressing the issues that you have raised. You're entitled to a response to your request. So I want to ask that we get that and that the board members receive it prior to the next board meeting.
We'd be happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much and appreciate your coming. That concludes the list of people who had asked to testify. Unless there's anyone else in the audience who failed to sign up.
Can I just...
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Silva, do you have written comments? Because I know you had a few more things to say. Maybe you could provide that with staff.
Oh, yes.
I can leave this, yes.
Good. Thank you. Thanks for that. The clerk will take the copy of it. I assume we have your earlier correspondence as well. So, okay. Thank you. With that, we are going to adjourn for lunch. And when we're finished, but before 2 o'clock, we will come out announce, as I said, any decisions that might have been made by the board as a result of the executive session that we'll be holding. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. It's 1:30, and we're resuming after the lunch break. I'm reporting back from the executive session. The board members were briefed on two litigation items and gave input to our general counsel. There were no decisions, however, that were taken at the meeting. This is both about ongoing litigation matters. And with that, I believe we are finished with all the rest of our business. And so without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Goldstein.
Thank you.